Let's go ahead and call the meeting to order of the Santa Claus County Employees Retirement Association. Roll call, please.
Mike Lynch.
Present.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill. Jeff Grover.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Jagan Raja Ford, Gordon Ford here.
Joan Clem Bennett.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay. Are there any announcements?
I have. You want to go first?
Okay. I have a couple. We're rolling into the fifth year of our lease for our tenant. And so we will be working on the contract negotiations for that. That has to be settled by August of this coming year. And I also wanted to give you a heads up that we are working with the district attorney's office to upgrade the security, the electronic security in this building. We will be bringing that to you with the budget. And our part of it is probably looking close to about $30,000 just to do the camera and equipment and stuff. So you'll have more information on that, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that it's coming your way.
And I'd like to take a moment and introduce two guests that we have with us today. They're from Northern Trust, Gary Gilbert. Some of you might have already met Gary.
Yes.
In Chicago. And he's like our first point of contact as a liaison between Stan Sarah and Northern Trust. And then we have Matt Poff, correct?
Correct.
And out of what's your role, Matt? How do you fit into this all?
I'm the day-to-day contact, so facilitate, make sure custody accounting gets out on time, it's accurate, new account openings, just any inquiries I facilitate them throughout the trust. Basically, the first point of contact.
And it's a tremendous pleasure working with these folks here, and they're always very responsive, and they pretty much give us everything we ask for. So, do you guys want to say anything, or you just want to sit and listen?
I haven't scared to say anything after that intro because I'm a ruiner. But I do want to thank the board for continuing service and your building all the trust. We really appreciate the business you've used in Sarah as a strategic role for us in California. So, thanks again.
Thank you. That's all.
Okay, public comment. Since we have some folks here, I know they're related to business before the board, but is there anyone here that wants to address the board on items not on the posted agenda? Okay, seeing no hands go up, I'm going to skip the public comment admonition. Moving on to consent items. Is there any member of the board that wishes to pull an item from the consent calendar?
Yeah, I'd like to pull item, I think it's item E, and we don't need to discuss it today if that's permissible, because I know we have a long agenda, but I want to talk about it later. So okay. Can we do that?
So you want to pull it
on a future agenda?
Put it on a future
agenda.
Okay.
So you want to have a discussion and action type agenda item, or just to discuss in more
detail? I want to discuss in more detail.
All right.
Okay. So we're pulling item 5E. Is there any other items board members wish to pull?
E.
E like Edward. Okay, seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve
the balance of the consent.
I'll second.
Okay, motion by Jeff Grover, second by Donna Riley. Is there any further discussion? Hearing or seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, we'll move on now to item six. And before we go to item six, since we have a lot of people here, just please speak up loudly and clearly so that everyone can hear you and we can get it recorded properly. Okay, so now we'll move on to item six.
All right, item 6A, this is a discussion and action item. This is the actuarial audit of the 30th 2015 actuarial evaluation and the 2012-2015 actuarial experience study. Staff's recommendation today will be after the presentation to accept the actuarial audit of the June 30th, 2015 actuarial evaluation and the 2012-2015 actuarial experience study. We have with us from Bartell Associates, Deanna Van Baylor. I know Deanna very well from a long time, and we've worked together in the past, and she's a great actuary. And we also have TAC, I'm not sure the last name. Okay. And so they're going to be presenting the actuarial audit. I'd really like to get at least one of you up at the table if we could. You know what? I could step aside. And you want to come and sit here?
Sure, I can talk here.
You sure?
I have a loud voice.
All right, Deanna.
It's better if she's at the table for recording.
Yeah, I would. Why don't you come sit here, Deanna?
Okay. Good afternoon and thank you. As Rick mentioned, my name is Deanna Van Baylor from Bartell Associates. I brought with me my associate, Todd Frazita, who was instrumental in the review. We're going to cover two items, the review of the 630-15 valuation and the 630-12 to 630-15 experience study. The purpose of the review of the valuation is basically to provide assurance to Stansera that all of the actuarial calculations, actuarial methods, actuarial assumptions, and conclusions are all reasonable and conform to actuarial standards of practice. The scope of the review covered, first of all, participant data, the plan provisions, in other words, the benefits that are promised, the actuarial cost method, the asset valuation method, obviously valuation results, contribution rate calculations, both employer and employee, and finally the report itself and the disclosures contained in the report. Our methodology started off that, first of all, we compared data between what Stansera provided and what Chiron used. So we actually started with data directly from Stansera, ran it through all of our normal data procedures, and then compared that to what Chiron used for their final valuation. We also independently summarized the Stansera benefit provisions, meaning we actually looked into the 37 Act law, went to your website, looked at the list of plan provisions, and came up with here's what the benefits are to be valued and compared that with the valuation. We compared the assumptions used in the valuation with those recommended in the experience study, and we used those in our valuation model as well. We ran what are referred to as sample lives, where we pick sample representative people within each different tier, general safety, and looked at those results compared to Chiron, discussed any differences and questions we had with Chiron, and if there was any disagreements. We noted that in our report. We reviewed and evaluated the assets and the asset valuation method. And then finally, what we did was ran a parallel valuation using Chiron's data and compared results. And the goal was to see, well, how closely can we replicate those valuation results and the resulting contribution calculations? And again, like I said, our goal was to independently review and analyze all these valuation results to make sure that the appropriate benefits were valued accurately, all the valuation results, including the unfunded accrued liability, are reasonable, and all the mathematical calculations are complete and accurate. And as a last step, we reviewed the report for compliance with actuarial standards and clarity and completeness. So briefly, I wanted to run through our findings. The data was a very, very close match. So we believe it is reasonable and is used in the valuation, complies with all actuarial standards of practice. Sorry, that's what the ASOP is, actuarial standards of practice, regarding data quality. There was a few minor differences, mostly attributable to transferred members and an annualization of valuation earnings for a few usually new hires. Very, very small differences. We only had a couple of recommendations. One is for Stansera to improve some of their data maintenance that was mentioned in our report. The main one had to do with new retirees. There's typically a lag in reporting when new retirees show up, and so there's often past payments so it's not always the payment going forward that's in the data. And we discussed with Chiron perhaps a slight modification in their valuation pay for some of those new hires. In terms of liability matches, everything was well within acceptable ranges. There was a few areas where we believe benefits were not correctly valued, and these are very, very small impacts. Tier 3, if you looked at just within Tier 3, it might have looked like a slightly larger percentage, but that's because Tier 3 is so small. It has a very small impact on your overall liability. Tiers 4 and 5, there was also one little small thing that, again, it's a very small percentage of the liability. Our overall calculation was within 0.6% of Chiron's. That's a very good result. For the asset review, we verified the market value of assets. We replicated the calculation of the actuarial value of assets, and we believe the methodology for the actual value of assets is reasonable and meets actuarial standards of practice. The only recommendations we had with respect to the assets really has to do with establishing future policies. Just to note that there's a 20% market corridor that you say that the actuarial value of assets has to be within 20% of whatever market value is. And in the event there's a severe market downturn, such as what we experienced in 08-09, then your smoothing doesn't work so well. And that I'm sure you've probably already discussed this. Another thing to think of, again, for the future is that if there's a change that affects only one group, so maybe it affects a single special district, for instance. Right now, the current methodology would allocate costs across all groups, and you might want to consider in advance having a policy for how to handle that. When we reviewed the employer contribution rates, we made sure the calculation of the total unfunded was correct. We made sure that the total employer and employee normal cost was reasonable, calculated accurately, and we believe the employer contribution rates developed in the valuation are reasonable and accurate. Our only comments as to recommendations, as you know, your unfunded liability is being amortized over a current period of 21 years, which decreases each year. So what happens is, in the future, when it starts getting a very short period, that can cause a lot of volatility, and you probably want to go ahead and think about having a policy in advance to handle when it gets down to a smaller period of time.
And we already have that.
I thought you might. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Good. Finally, with respect to the employer contribution weights, we did recommend that the report contain a more detailed description involving the allocation of the assets, the unfunded, how administrative expenses are broken out between groups, because there's allocations going on between general and safety and the tiers and the different employers, and it would just it would be better for transparency purposes if there was a more in-depth description of that. And finally, we wanted to mention that we believe the report should specify that the PEPRA Tier 6 contribution rate only applies to member earnings up to that PEPRA limit. So we're pretty sure that's how it was calculated. The next thing we looked at, we did a very high-level review of the GASB 6768 calculation. In general, everything in the report is accurate and in accordance with GASB 6768, and we had a few comments on that in our report. When we took a look at the report itself, we had basically, we suggested a number of small additional disclosures, which is more to just improve the level of completeness and transparency of the report itself. We also took a look at member contributions. We independently replicated all the member contribution rates, which is basic and COLA, for each tier. All the calculations are in accordance with 37 Act rules, and they use appropriate assumptions and methods. We did disclose a few minor inconsistencies in our report, which have a very small impact on the rate calculation. And we'd also like to see the report include a more in-depth description of how those rates are calculated. The second part of our review is to take a look at the triennial experience study. Similar to the valuation, the purpose of this review is to provide assurance to Stansera that all the actuarial calculations, methods, considerations, and analyses are reasonable and conform to actuarial standards of practice. The scope of our review included an evaluation of the data. We took a look at the recommended assumptions, which included both economic and demographic assumptions. We independently reproduced the experience study based on the historical data files provided by Chiron, and we evaluated the study results and reconciled any discrepancies that we might have found. The methodology that we used, we independently modeled the expected rate of return on assets. We used historical data files, meaning participant data files, from Chiron to independently replicate the study results for retirement rates, termination rates, salary increases. For other assumptions, and these would have to do with things like vacation cash outs, disablements, because there wasn't enough real experience to go on there, we used professional judgment to evaluate the methodologies and conclusions. Our findings. We concur with Chiron's conclusions. Just a few notes. The discount rate has only a very small margin for conservatism. And I would like to point out that at the time the study was done, it's sort of a different era than it is now. All the boards, you know, other boards are looking right now at discount rates. And we believe it will be likely that you'll want to consider a reduction in your discount rate and perhaps the inflation rate, maybe in the next experience study, maybe sooner. I mean, look what CalPERS is doing right now. That's just a movement. But given the time of the study, you know, we agree with those conclusions. For the demographic assumptions review, again, we concur with Chiron's conclusions. Actuarial standards of practice 35 is met. We replicated our results very closely, and we believe the calculations are accurate and the recommended assumptions are reasonable and appropriate. We had a few technical comments and recommend one, that there be a documentation or rationale for use of retirement rates that do not differ by the benefit and tier. It's typically you do see retirement rates that differ by benefits, and typically that's because, take for example, the PEPR tier. Those people are getting lower benefits. So the thought is that in general, those people may be retiring a little bit later as they work a little bit longer in order to accrue as big a benefit as the other tiers would get. It's a little early for some of these tiers to actually see how, we don't have a good record of the pattern of retirements yet, but that will be coming. So just that's just a thought. And we also made a few technical comments regarding the clarity of the vacation cash out and unused sick leave assumptions. Very, very small assumption changes. In summary, I'd like to assure the board that you have, you should be very happy with this report. The results are great. You've been just given a good report card. We matched and replicated Chiron's work very closely, and we've said in our report that the valuation and the experience study are reasonable and conform to actuarial standards of practice. So the board has its assurance that all of this is good. And finally, in closing, I'd like to say thank you very much to both Stansera's staff and Chiron. You guys were great to work with. Made it very easy. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. And if you have any questions at all, we'll entertain them right now.
So you think that our discount rate, I mean, you think we have to change it soon or revisit it?
I think it would be prudent to revisit it in light of the current new market assumptions that are available. Everything we're hearing right now says that the new 10-year projections have been coming down over the last year.
Do you know if you looked at it based on, so at the time we did this study, they hadn't made any, they did an asset liability study last year and made some significant changes to the portfolio.
Correct. Underway.
We didn't. This study, our experience analysis for the discount rate was done before the rate changes, which those changes were expected to increase the expected rate of return. You know, if you had looked at the allocation, the same one that we had used in our original analysis, or was it the most recent?
Do you know which one?
I don't recall one or the other.
I think it was. I'm not sure. I thought it was the one that you used.
Because yeah, they did, they went a little more risk into some classes. That
and a little
some
riskier. Expire,
some higher expected rates of return for those classes after we completed our study. Is that right?
Okay. I
think the message here, though, is that we're going to continue and press on like we always do, and we will always take a hard look at the discount rate at least every 3 years and probably sooner than that. In fact, I think we're going to actually look at capital market expectations in a couple months again. So this is always on our radar and always on our plate, as it is with everybody else.
Right.
So did Chiron have a chance to respond to your minor recommendations? Are there any disagreements?
No, and during our presentation on the results, we'll show you the impact and any changes we made as a result of the audit, how they affect the calculations.
Okay. So in your expert opinion, how this your study compares with some of the other work you might have done, like as far as where Sarah evaluation stands?
Oh, I think it was a very, very good report where we were only finding very small little things to recommend differences and changes.
Thank you.
I just have one note. On page 30 of your draft document that was sent to all of us, the top paragraph, vacation cash out, and I know a few years ago you had to put a load factor in on contributions to take that into account. This document says it is possible, at the bottom of the top area, it is possible that members with 36-month final average pay formulas would choose to cash out vacation in each of their final 3 years rather than only in the final year. County policy doesn't allow for that. So if you're going to take advantage of that, so are you recommending we should put that language in our report if the policy says?
It would provide more clarity,
okay,
because we weren't sure when we read it. We weren't sure why it was being done the way it was, and when you said, "Oh, that's how the benefits, that's how it works,"
okay,
then that makes complete sense,
okay,
why it was done that way.
Okay.
And we did not.
So
know
we'll
that.
Just add that clarification. Okay, fine. That's all I have.
Okay, a motion to accept the report.
Okay, second. Jeff beat you to it.
Can I ask a question on page 10?
Absolutely.
If you look at the last paragraph, I was curious about what difference that would make. And
to include a description of the allocation, the difference it makes is simply that we were unable to replicate the calculations until we talked to them. And
it's just a disclosure issue. Not a difference in how we would do any of the calculations.
Okay, so it wouldn't make any difference in the final numbers?
No.
Okay. And we've already started to build that projection in, or that
added some more description
to this year's evaluation report. Okay.
It seemed like the comments about the GASB 6768 were kind of similar. They had more to do with disclosure of methodologies rather than factual numbers.
Yes, in general, I think as long as so GASB 6768 is a little trickier. As long as your auditors are okay with it, usually that means everything's good. We would have probably done things a little bit differently, but the auditors were obviously okay with it.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, we have a motion and a second to approve the Bartell & Associates actuarial review of June 30, 2015 and the actuarial evaluation and the July 1st, 2012 through June 30, 2015 experience study. All those in, you have another question?
No.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move now on to item 6B, discussion and action regarding 2016 preliminary actuarial evaluation results. Graham?
Thanks. I just wanted to first say thank you to Dan and Taka and everybody else at Bartell. It was a pleasure to work with them. We appreciate their suggestions. A lot of their suggestions about adding more detail and the disclosures, we're going to be putting into the June 30, 2016 evaluation report. So the short report is just a little bit longer. So thank you guys
very much. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn it over to Chip to make the presentation on the preliminary evaluation results. And then we also have for you today a projection of the contribution rates going forward. So how have things changed from last year to this year, and then how has our outlook changed going forward based on the events that occurred in the last 12 months?
Thanks, Ren. Again, my name is John Chipko, and as you heard, Ren referred to me as Chip, so please feel free to call me that, too. We'll be going through the evaluation of results for 2016 today and highlight some changes that happened since the last evaluation. On slide two of the presentation, we're showing some of the results from 2015 and 2016 next to each other. The 15 results are on the left, the 16 results on the right. At the top of the chart, we show the actuarial liability relative to the actuarial value of assets. And you can see that there's an unfunded liability at June 30, 2016 of $691 million. And that results in a funded ratio of about just short of 73%. Now, these numbers are the numbers used to calculate the contribution rates going forward. Relative to last year, the unfunded liability has increased, and the funded ratio has decreased by about 1%. In the middle of the page, we're showing the market value of assets and the associated funded ratio. Now, the actuarial value of assets are smooth in an effort to smooth the contribution rate, so there's not too much volatility. The market value of assets is a snapshot to show as of a certain date where things are. So there, you can see there's a bigger drop in the market value funded ratio than on the ABA terms. So it's dropped from 75.8% to 69.1%. And it's important when you look at these results to compare the actuarial value of assets to the market value of assets. This can give you an idea of where things are heading in the future. And you'll notice that the relationship has changed from last year to this year. So last year, the market value of assets was higher than the actuarial value of assets. That meant there were some gains that had built up in the actuarial value of assets, and that would be smoothed into the contribution rates. So contribution rates could be expected to stay flat or sort of decline a little bit. Now this year, the relationship has flipped so that the actuarial value of assets is higher than the market value of assets. That means there's some losses that have built up that still need to be recognized. And that means that the contribution rate in the short term can be expected to increase to pay for those losses. Down below at the bottom of the page, we're showing the full contribution rate, or the calculated contribution rate, and that's increased about 1%, 30.86% last year to 31.94% this year. Now, that wasn't the contribution rate paid by the employer. Instead, we're phasing in some changes made last year. New assumptions were adopted, both economic and demographic, which we just talked about. And so there was a decision made to phase in the recognition of those assumption changes over 3 years. Last year, the phased-in rate was 24.99%. And this year, the phase-in is up to 29%. So there's 1 year left of the phase-in, and next year you could expect that the full contribution rate is fully phased in.
On slide three, you wanted to highlight a few of the changes to last year and how that impacted the contribution rate. The biggest single item is, from year to year, is the investment returns. The market value of investment returns for the year ending June 30, 2016 was negative 1.7%. That's relative to the expected return of 7.25%. So that's about a 9% difference there. That's a loss that will need to be paid via contributions over time. Now, that's on a market value basis, and that's not used to calculate the contribution rate. Instead, to see what impact there will be this year, we need to look at the return on the actuarial value of assets. And that's the second bullet there. The calculated return was 6.3%, again, versus the 7.25%. So, again, when we're smoothing out the gains and losses, there's a much smaller loss. That represents about $16.3 million and increased the contribution rate for this year by 0.46% of PAC. The third bullet there talks about the impact of the lag in the contribution rates. So the calculation is completed assuming that the contribution rate applies immediately, but that's not what actually happens. Instead, there's a year lag for administrative purposes. The valuation has to be calculated, and the employer has to know what rates withhold. And because of that lag, there was an increase in the rate in the pay, 0.52% increase in the contribution rate because of that lag. And the primary reason for that fairly large number is because of the adoption of the new assumptions. Last year, new assumptions were adopted effective 6/30/2015, but the contribution rate paid for the year was based on the prior assumption. So there was a little bit of a lag there, and that caused the contribution rate to increase.
So in general, anytime you've got a pattern where your contribution rates are going up, that lag is going to mean that you're under-contributing in that year, so you have to make up that payment in future years. If you have a pattern where your contribution rate is declining as a percentage of pay, then the opposite will be true. It means you kind of end up over-contributing for 1 year, and that will reduce your contributions further in future years. You're always going to have that one-year lag because, you know, the valuation date is as of June 30th. We don't have the valuation done on June 30th, right? It takes us several months to have that done. So you can't have the contributions go into effect until the following fiscal year.
The fourth bullet here is related to the audit that we just discussed. And so by implementing the changes recommended by Bartel, that increased the contribution rate by 0.03% of PAC. The fourth item shows the impact of updating the data from 1 year to the next. All the salary and the demographic information in the census specification. Those all combined together increased the contribution rate by 0.07% of PAC. And there were sort of some competing elements at play here. On one hand, there were some losses because salary increases were larger than expected. There were also some losses because COLA increases were larger than expected. The COLA increase was 3%, and the assumed increase was 2.7%. Now, this was offset by a few other items, including the hire of members into the PEPRA tier. Those, as people in earlier tiers retire and are replaced by members in the PEPRA tier, they have a lower normal cost, lower accrual rate. And so there is some savings there.
Hey, Jonathan, are you finding this migration into the new PEPRA tier happening faster than what you anticipated originally?
Well, I think one thing that really accelerated this year is that there was a large increase in the active population, relatively large increase in the active population. If I look in the appendix, the number of actives in the plan increased by 2.5%. So usually we're expecting the active population to remain relatively stable. And now that 2.5% increase, those members are all hired into PEPRA. So that's a big increase, not just the people who are retiring and being replaced, but that increased population is all appearing in the PEPRA tier. So I would say that that the size of the PEPR tier relative to the whole population is a bit larger than we had anticipated originally.
Is that just for Stancera, or are you seeing that up and down the state for PEPR tiers?
So I've seen the rates maybe slightly higher than I expected, but it's kind of remarkable. If you take our projection software, you take it back a year, and you plug in what the actual asset return is, not just for you, but by and large, our numbers are coming in really close. So we had expected a decent savings from the PEPR members, probably on the 20 to 30 basis points per year for the first few years, and that's about what we're seeing.
Okay.
So it's actually pretty close in line with what we've been expecting.
And that should level off, obviously.
It'll level off, or it'll slow down over time. But if when we get into the projections and you can see the direction of costs, those projections have been pretty good so far at predicting what contribution rates would have been other than through the asset experience.
Right, the asset experience really drives a lot of this. The liability gains and losses don't have nearly the same impact.
And you're also getting to see that the normal costs for the PEPR tiers are starting to stabilize. Right, when we look at the normal cost, right, is the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year. And it's highly dependent on the age at which people are hired. So in those first couple of years, it really depended. If you hired maybe 10 people into a safety group, if they were all a little older than average, you might have a higher normal cost. And then if you hired some people the next year that were, you know, basically new hires, they may have a lower cost. So you may have seen that cost bounce around a little bit, the contribution rates for those new tiers for the first few years. But now we're seeing that those tiers have sizable enough populations that they're a bit more stable. So the average age at which people are hired into those tiers isn't changing as much.
And that's universal statewide, all the systems?
Yeah, and it's just because you've got more people, right? I mean, when you only have a couple people, one person can make a pretty big difference on the cost. You know, you hire one person who was like, they came in as a, you know, as an older, you know, officer or something, that can affect the cost a lot.
I know it's early in the life of PEPR, but do any of your other plans actually fund PEPR tiers all by themselves, assets and liabilities?
Nobody that I work with has separated out assets.
So we can't really
for the tiers.
Okay. So we no, can't really look at volatility.
No, because really what we're, you know, these are still cost-sharing pool plans.
Yeah. Right?
You're really, that's part of the whole thing is all for one, one for all in terms of sharing the risk across the different groups. You see differences in the normal cost, the cost of the benefits that people are actually earning. But as far as the unfunded liability, everybody that I work with has been pooling that.
So, Graham, on the bullet there that said largest losses from salary increases, I mean, our projections have always been pretty close. So what was the data that skewed that?
So if you remember, you had some pretty sizable increases for a couple groups, and we tried to account for most of that in the last couple valuations. Remember, we actually built into our projections for some of those bargaining groups, they were going to get some they were getting a couple of years of raises right at that time. But there were some groups that we just didn't have that data when we were in the valuation. So when their new contracts, these are one-time adjustments,
right,
for when their contracts went in, their pay increased by more than we had expected for those individuals. As far as the COLAs go, that was just
right,
3% COLA.
Right.
But unless you have some really, you know, unless you anticipate another set of bargaining agreements that are coming through right now that have sort of retroactive pay increases for a few years, I wouldn't expect to see that again.
Okay.
And just to touch on the last bullet here, the amortization period for the UAL, so the period of time which the UAL is paid down, has dropped to 20 years. And this is a bit of a milestone for the plan because it's no longer experiencing negative amortization. So what does that mean? If you want to keep your unfunded liability from growing, you need to do two things. You have to, or on an expected basis, I'll add that caveat at all times, on an expected basis, you have to pay for two things. You have to pay for the benefits accruing during the year, which would be the normal cost, and you need to pay for the interest on the unfunded liability. It's always accruing interest. So now, because the period has dropped to 20 years, now the amortization payment is expected to pay for both of those pieces. with a little bit going down to pay down sort of the principal or the UAL itself. So now on an expected basis, the UAL is expected to drop each year.
And Jenna made a good point during their audit that at some point we need a plan for what to do when that unfunded liability amortization period comes down. I know in the past we've talked about different options in terms of adding layers to the unfunded, like new layers when there's a new unfunded liability. At this point, your policy is, I think, fine for the next few years to just have that 20 coming down by one each year. You'll be paying more and more of the principal of the unfunded liability. You'll see the funded ratio increase if all of our assumptions are met. Right. So it's not an immediate need, but I would say within the next 4 or 5 years, we should develop some kind of a plan for how to treat future changes in the unfunded liability.
Right now, we're freezing it when it hits 15. That's the policy.
Is that in the actual?
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
So just to let you know that type of a policy, so there's been a lot of guidance issued in the last few years about that would be called a rolling amortization policy. And from a personal perspective, I don't actually think that's necessarily a bad thing. But some of the actual guidance out there has said, you know, it's better if you can actually have a closed amortization period and say you're actually going to pay this unfunded liability off by a certain point in time. Because it just allows you to answer the question, when is this going to be paid off? Right? So a lot of plans have been moving away from rolling amortization towards these closed amortization periods.
So is that closed for, like, if we layered it, say that piece of the that piece would be paid off at this point in time, that piece would be paid off? Okay.
So the unfunded liability that exists as of today would be paid off in 20 years? And then say there was a new unfunded liability that came about next year because there was either an investment gain or a loss, you would pay that
for
its own
set.
20-year period. That's why they call it layered amortization.
And I can tell you from personal experience there are issues with that as well.
Sure, because then like a layer can go away.
You get
right?
A cliff.
Then we have these things called smoothing and we phase in and phase out. It's a topic for another day.
So, Graham, does this impact the contribution rates, like the fact that it's now coming from 21 years to 20 years? Does that have any impact to the employers or employees' contribution rate?
We are amortizing it as a level percentage of payroll. So if all of your assumptions are met and payroll grows by 3.25%, then the unfunded liability payment, if you don't have any other gains or losses, will be the same percentage of pay next year that it was this year.
As the years drop.
Right. So as that payment, you know, that 20 years goes down to 19 years, but if all of your assumptions are met, the payment as a percentage of pay should still be the same amount. It'll just be 3.25% more in dollar terms.
Right.
Of course, nothing ever happens as expected. So here on the next slide, speaking of that, we put itemized sort of all of these items that we just talked about. And at the top of the chart is the full contribution rate from last year, 30.86%, along with the three components of it: the normal cost at 12.24%, the amortization at the unfunded amortization at 17.66%, and the administrative expenses at 0.96%. And down below, you can see that we break out all of the different pieces. The first line is the investment loss on the actuarial value of assets. The second is the contribution for shortfall. That's what we refer to as the loss due to the lag, the timing of the contribution. The third item is the demographic changes. And then on the prior slide, we had sort of lumped together the third and fourth buckets there. Demographic changes and then the change due to effect of payroll on the amortization. And this goes to the point we were just talking about. We had expected payroll to increase by 3.25%, but instead payroll actually increased by about 5.5%. So that larger increase in the total payroll caused the amortization rate to drop. And then the final bullet there is the change due to the audit updates. And then we show the full contribution rate along with the phase-in and the phased-in rate. that will, of course, be going away in the next valuation. There will be no more abatement. Here we're showing some historical data on the funded level of the plan. The gray bars are the actuarial liability. The green line is the market value of assets. That's, again, the snapshot date, so you can see it's a little bit more volatile moving up and down. And the yellow line is the actuarial value of assets, the smooth value of assets. And you can see that that moves more in a straight line upward. And again, I'll point to the change in the relationship between the green and yellow line. Last year, the market value was above, the last 2 years actually, the market value was above the actuarial value, so there were some gains built up, and now it's flipped over. So now there's some losses built up in the actuarial value of assets, and that's going to cause the contribution rate to increase if all assumptions are met. Here's some historical information on the contribution rates. The red line is the employee contribution rate, the aggregate employee contribution rate. The blue line, the blue dashed line, shows the computed employer rate, full employer rate. And the green line is the phased-in rate. So in 2015, you can see the big increase in the computed rate is because of the new assumptions that were adopted. And that's when the current phase-in began. And you can see there's been an increase in the employer rate this year, and that the phase-in has sort of closed the gap, a lot closer to the employer rate as we move closer to fully phasing it. And here's some historical data on experience gains and losses. The yellow bar represents investment gains and losses on a market value basis, and the gray bar is liability gains and losses. You see everything's kind of dwarfed by the losses that happened in 2010 on the asset side. And then the line shows the net experience gains and losses. And so you can see that this year, 2016, sort of both went in the negative direction for the plan. There were asset losses and liability losses. And that is everything we wanted to review.
So we'll come back next month with a full valuation report. I don't know if you want to come back in person or not, but we will provide you with a full valuation report. It has even more detail after taking those suggestions from Deanna to put a few more tables in there. But again, we don't expect any changes from the information that we've already provided you. It's really worked its way most of the way through our peer review already. And again, that report will determine the contribution rates for fiscal year 17-18. We have a few appendices slides, but really what we'd rather do at this time is just switch over to the projections briefly. We did want to bring these to you now because based on that negative market value return for fiscal year 15-16, these projections have changed quite a bit from last year. So if you look at the projections below here, the yellow is the employer contribution with gold bars. The contribution rates themselves are shown above, so 29%, right? That's the rate that we just talked about. That's expected to increase up to 32.4% next year when we're phasing in that last chunk of the assumption changes from the 2014 experience study. That's why you see a pretty big increase in the contribution rates expected next year. Now, these red dashed lines is what we showed you in the projections last year, right? So you can see that the difference between the red line, that where we are right now, and that red line, that's mostly based on the difference in the return that we had for this year, right, plus the liability losses. It's not a big difference. But remember, we're only recognizing 1/5 of those investment losses in the contribution rate this year. So that's why you see 4 years out from now, there's a much bigger difference between the dotted red line, which is what we showed you in the projected last year, and then the gold bars, which is actually reflecting the full amount of that investment loss once it's fully phased in over the next 4 years. So we did think it was important to point out.
So we go up to 45? Is that what you're...
No, so the maximum contribution rate in this projection is 35.3% of pay.
So the y-axis is the sum of the employer
and employee. It's the sum of the employee and the employer. So the employee rate are the gray bars at the bottom.
I got it. Okay.
So we thought this was important to show, at least for the county in terms of budgeting, because these estimates have changed, you know, by about 5% of pay since last year, as once you fully phased in that investment change. Now, of course, who knows what the fiscal year 16-17 return is going to look like? I know, you know, Ed probably can talk to that, but a lot of my clients have said they've done pretty well so far this year, but who knows what happens in a three-month period.
Or tonight.
Or tonight.
Yeah.
There you go.
Someone's making a speech, I believe.
Yeah. So we could change that if you wanted to see how it affects the contribution rates. We can actually change the investment return for fiscal year 16-17, and I can show you how that affects the rates. And we can also talk about, I think probably leaving changes to the amortization policy for another day, but obviously we do have the ability to change those things as well, and that is part of the policies that this board controls.
And there is one other thing I'd like to point out about the contribution rates. We were talking about how PEPRA impacts the contribution rates, and you can sort of see as the gold bars, they sort of peak in 2020 at 35.3, and then after that there's a gradual decline. That is the impact of the PEPRA members replacing other tiered members. And you can see that gradual decline every year is that decrease in the normal cost that we'd expect from new PEPRA members.
So right, when you go from 2020 to 2021, it's about 30 basis points, no, I'm sorry, about 10 basis points difference, and then 20 basis points and 20. So those are all rounded numbers. So it's probably not going to be happening as quickly as it has the last few years, but you still see some decline in that normal cost.
And then the other thing I'd point out is in 2036, at the very end, the amortization, that's 20 years later. That's 20 years from now. So the based on the current amortization policy, all of, you know, this is not using the 15-year roll. So that means the amortization is done. That's what it would look like if you actually paid it off over 20 years. Now, if you change it to rolling at 15 years, then things will look a little bit different going forward.
Right. And you can see that at the end of that, the employer contribution rate is pretty close to the employee contribution rate, which makes sense because they're each paying half the normal cost. The difference is that the employer is still paying the administrative expenses.
Well, so isn't that 34%, whatever, give or take a couple percent, isn't that really on the low side of 37 Act counties?
I don't think it's abnormally low. It's it's probably a little on the low side. I do know our neighbor to the south, they're getting up above 50 this year.
And Fresno is pretty high too, right?
But I also have some plants that are in the low 30s, high 20s.
Okay. So, Graham, your next report will break it down by tier, right? The actual contribution rate. Now, you know, from prior year, it's going up 16% in aggregate for the entire system. So what that means is some tiers will be higher than likely than the 16, and some will be lower than the 16, right?
You know, usually, so we calculate an unfunded liability rate, a UAL rate, separately for the general employees and for the safety employees, and for the county and for serious and special systems, right? Mm-hmm. So that unfunded liability rate tends to change, and we apply it across all tiers.
Right.
So tier 1, 2, 3, 4, they all pay that same unfunded liability rate. That's the rate that you'll see an increase in those rates this year. The normal cost rates, we charge those for each individual tier. Those don't tend to change very much from year to year.
Mm. Okay. So
it's more like all boats kind of going up as the unfunded liability goes up.
If the rate of return isn't good and we have to change that, and I know we pick up the difference, does the employee, if they're supposed to be 50%, is there?
No, the employee rate, the employees pay half the cost of the normal cost. They do not pay.
But
the
if normal is based on a return of 7 million.
If you change your expected rate of return, right, if you change your assumption, then the employee contributions will go up. If
okay.
the actual returns are below what you expect, then that affects your unfunded liability, which does not affect the employee contribution rates. The employee contribution rates only change if you change your assumption about future returns.
Okay.
All right, Cornel. And The amortization period, we set at 21, and we're working our way down.
Is it 20 this year? Yeah.
So what if you get to the 10-year mark and the projections, your assumptions aren't realized? Do we just start over? We just establish a new period? Or do we live with it?
That is a good topic for discussion. As of right now, you know, next year the amortization period will be 19 years.
Right.
You still have a bit of time to plan for that. But I do think it's worth having a conversation at some point about how do we want to approach the unfunded liability long term? Do we actually want to figure out a time to pay off every last dollar of the unfunded liability that exists now and do something else if we have, say, an assumption change in the future that changes the liability? Do we want to keep it all together and just have one single payment schedule? I think it's a good topic for, you know, for a future board meeting.
Okay, but the unfunded liability is the difference between the 72.8% and 100.
Right, yeah.
So as we get closer to 100, that rate drops.
No.
Or is it a fixed amount because that's what it is?
So if you look at the top graph here is showing the funded ratio. If you see those numbers at the very top of the graph, that's showing how the funded ratio would improve over time. So you can see it's improving and getting closer and closer to 100 and finally hit that again. But there's no real flux, there's very limited fluctuation in the employer contribution rates at the bottom. And that's because, as Graham's talked about before, the contribution rate is a level percent of pay. Now, the rate, that's if you have this closed amortization period, the 20 years, and it just continues to drop down, and there's no other gains and losses. That's always the comment. But when things are going to happen, and so you will see the rate fluctuate, but it's not going to get smaller as you get closer to 100, unless there's some change to the amortization policy. So instead of going down to 1, if you stop at 15 years, then that might change the contribution rate for the unfunded liability.
Think about it this way. Think about it like it's, so right now you have a 20-year mortgage, right?
Okay.
And in our projection, 20 years out, you've paid off your mortgage. The asset line is the same as the liability line. And in that same year, you have paid off the mortgage, so you don't make that payment anymore. So your unfunded liability payment, which had been about 23% of pay, that goes away. And all you're left with is the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year. Now, of course, we know that it's not going to happen. We know in 20 years there's going to be something that happens between now and then. And who knows if any of us will be
in this room. Cycle.
Right. But there needs to be a plan to pay for changes that happen after today. How do you deal with that? How do you pay for those changes over time?
Right. I think sometimes we lose sight of that unfunded liability represents how much needs to be contributed to close the gap. It already takes into account all the future expected investment returns at the 7.25. So 7.25 returns aren't going to close that gap at all. It's contributions that close that gap.
So if next year, year after, we change from 7.5 to 7.25 or 7, what does it do to this?
So the liability numbers will go up, right? Because
the unfunded.
The unfunded will, the liability will go up, so the unfunded will go up, right? Because the assets don't change.
Right.
Your contribution rates will go up because you have a larger unfunded liability, and the normal cost increases, right? Because the cost of providing, a retirement benefit is going to increase if you're not going to earn as much money on those investments. So your unfunded liability goes up because the past liabilities go up. Your normal cost rate goes up because everything goes up. The employee rates also go up, right? So the employees on average over the long term are going to pay about half the normal cost. So their rates will go up as well.
So Graham, you hear me mention this all the time. So how much is impact on the employer rate is the mortality table? Because you guys have adopted some new mortality tables.
So that was part of what was phased in as part of the experience study.
I believe this year our assumptions were pretty
We did not, yes, I agree. Yeah. They were reasonably close, although it's only one, with the caveat that it's only 1 year.
Right. Experience. We didn't have any significant gains or losses from mortality experience being different than what
our assumptions. When you guys look at, I mean, you guys adopt a table that's sort of universally accepted. Are you really looking at our own data to show that, you know, we're, for males, we're picking, you know, let's say 76 is what we expect them to fall off our pension rolls? That's a nice way of saying, you know. Yeah, but so they're falling off at this age. Do we really have credible internal data that we're utilizing to say that? Because it doesn't matter how many have dropped off, because if they're dropping off at age 85, then they've gone 9 years under this scenario, so they're starting to become a liability. Do we have enough credible data to show that the table we're adopting really reflects our experience?
So we don't have enough data to generate your own table. We do have enough data to look at a more general table, and what we used was the CalPERS table, right? That's probably a pretty good starting place. They definitely have enough data to have a credible table. And then we adjusted those CalPERS tables to match up with, in aggregate, your experience. So are your members, on average, healthier, or, you know, do they live longer or shorter than
so
the CalPERS
tables? We moved it part of the way there. Yeah. We moved it all of the way.
Right.
Because your data was not
credible.
Didn't hit the full credit, right. It was partially credit.
So you take a weighted average, so to speak, of CalPERS data and our data.
Although the adjustments weren't very large.
The adjustments were not.
Yeah,
so we're starting to level out now?
Well, we've also built in what's called generational improvements. So we assume every year that the likelihood of death goes down a little bit, right? So that the chance of a 75-year-old dying this year is slightly lower than the chance of a 75-year-old dying last year, and that happens automatically.
And before, what was done before was called a static mortality projection.
Right.
So it was projected into the future, but then not changed. It's just the same
right.
table used every
based
year.
Based on the table.
Now, basically, you're using a new table automatically every year without any action on anybody's part.
And the nice thing about that for us is we could look and we could say, okay, every year, did these assumptions line up with the data? Do we have any big changes?
So do we live longer or shorter than the CalPERS people? Just kidding.
I would get longer.
I would say
they have more stress.
I would say shorter.
We had very minor changes to the CalPERS table for your experience, if I remember correctly. I think they were less than 5% adjustment factors. So not terribly different.
With the new pension software, Rick, are we going to get to a point in the future where we're going to start having some credible data?
I think we're a little...
That's purely based. It's not a...
It's the amount. It's the amount.
You need to have basically 1,000 deaths to be fully credible. You don't generally have 1,000 deaths over a 3-year period.
Yeah, it depends. So is how big is... How many retirees
live through?
No. No. I think we've killed this topic, so we.
This is riveting. Another 5 minutes, we're all going to sleep.
Thanks, Jeff.
We've been reading that the mortality rates are changing. So.
You mean in general, or the
yeah, in general, not necessarily.
And you know, that's why we come back every 3 years and we update these things. If experience changes, we'll change with it.
Right, and I think the place that probably would change is in that projection that we talked about, the generational projection. The Society of Actuaries releases a new model every year incorporating the latest data. So in 3 years, when we look at it again, we'll see what that latest information says.
Graham, on the left-hand side, we have the 7.25 returns. That's the assumed return for each one of those years.
Yeah.
So that leads us to the bottom. I think that's the geometric average, none of those things. But when we actually go through and do an asset allocation study, we're looking at a return with a volatility component. Is there a way we could model that to show a 7.25 on average, but something that gives us 11-12% volatility so we can see what that looks like, or maybe you've already done it.
Something like this.
Your wish is his commands.
So the black line is the...
You might not.
I don't think we've...
This chart is exactly why I always hesitated giving projections beyond 3 years to clients. There's just no way.
Because contribution rates are anywhere from zero to everything.
Yep.
So it doesn't look that much different. Right, it's still peaking. I think contribution rate here is peaking around 35% of pay. I believe here it's peaking around somewhere around 35% of pay, it looks like, right?
Mm-hmm.
The 50th percentile. And again, we have here we have, oh, that was with the 7. And what did you want to see for volatility?
12.
Sorry, rerun it again.
But that's not going to dramatically change it. We just changed there, so.
Right. But so what you're looking at here is the probability distribution of the contribution rates on an expectation that you earn 7.25% each year, but the mean is 7.25%, and then we do Monte Carlo simulation based on the volatility that we've provided. So. I'm colorblind, so I'm not going to try to repeat what those bars are, but you can see that the middle ones are the 40th to 60th percent, so in that middle 20% of the asset return scenarios, that's where your contribution rate lies.
That actually was interesting, because when it was done, that chart, all those bars
shrunk.
And we only changed the volatility by what seems minor, 14 to 12, so that is interesting.
Thanks for the question.
So any further questions?
Jody, any comment?
Yeah. So Jody Hayes from the County's Executive Office. First, we wanted to just say thank you very much for the phasing approach. It is very meaningful. It has a significant impact to our own budget projections from the county's perspective. We also appreciate the opportunity to sit through these projections. Brenda Cuddy and Patrice Teacher are here with me. This is kind of the brain trust of our county budget. And we look out and we plan at a good time 5 years in advance in terms of what we're going to do. So this is very informative. So thank you very much for the phasing. I am curious to know, I know for the last few years we've been trying to introduce this concept of between market value and actuarial value. We've talked about the funding ratio. Which one is more meaningful? I mean, is that a Rick or a Graham question? To you guys, when you're describing it to policymakers and the public, which one do you think is more meaningful? Because I'm getting tired of trying to describe it to those people, and I just want to land on 1.6.
So before Graham says what he wants to say, my thought on this was always, whatever you do, be consistent. So don't change to one or the other based on which one is better as you go through time. But I think as long as you're consistent, I think that's what's most important.
Consistency is good. Personally, I kind of like the market value better. It's what is going in your GASB statements now, right? I have a number of clients, and CalPERS has done this as well. They just got rid of the actual value altogether. There's no more actual value of assets. The point of the actual value of assets is to help you smooth out the contributions. But there's other ways to smooth out the contributions. You can just smooth out the contributions. You don't have to actually smooth the assets. You can do something called direct rate smoothing, where you take the amortization payments and you phase them in and phase them out, just like we're phasing in the impact of the assumption changes. So I personally think it's kind of weird to say, let's say you had some big losses this year, right? And now my actual value of assets is much higher, say 20% higher than my market value of assets. Would I really want to say that I'm
you know, 80% funded, even though if I only have 60 cents on the dollar in terms of the actual assets of the bank. So I tend to go with the market value assets, even though, or the market value funded ratio, even though it is a lot more volatile than the actual value.
And Jody, can you quantify for us the difference between 29% and 35% in terms of real dollars, what it's going to mean to the county every year?
Real dollars?
Yeah.
Well, the 29 to 12. Just doing the simple math, are you talking about in the current year, what we're looking at?
Well, what we're going to go, where we're at now. Versus
what we're at now, where we're going is we're projecting about, we're looking at a 16%, Mandy mentioned the number, a 16% increase in our total retirement costs.
Real dollars.
In terms of real dollars, is that about, I want to say 9, 10 million?
$250 million payroll.
So it's 2.5 million for every for every percent, 15 million.
So kind of go 10 or 12 million for what it is now.
60 million.
Close to that.
Last year. 60, yeah. So I'm at about 10 million, Jim. And of that, the general fund pays a large portion of retirement costs, close to 45% of our retirement costs. So it's a significant hit either way. I mentioned the long-range financial modeling. We tried to set aside some of our savings to incorporate the cost increases, but they're ongoing cost increases, which makes it difficult. It's not just a one-time hit. So while we can bridge the gap in one particular year, you have to build it into the model all the way around. And we'd like to see a more meaningful impact related to Pepper, but it's interesting to listen to the discussion and understand why you're not seeing more of a meaningful impact. But the Pepper population is quite huge. With this group. We're already really big. A lot of new employees. We essentially didn't hire for many years, and now we are.
I know about a year ago, Rick and I were running some numbers for some other reason, and oh my gosh, almost a quarter of our active population is already Pepper.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So for something that's only been in place for a few years, that's a lot. A lot of employees to have a quarter of our active population already there. So it just moved faster than we thought it was going to move.
A lot of my clients have gotten to about that 20 to 25%.
Yeah. And I think part of it is because, you know, we did have the downturn and we didn't hire, and a lot of people retired, and then Pepper came in. So when the money was there to hire again, that's where they came into. But I think we're all a little surprised at how quickly we built that up.
There's been no slowdown, I'm assuming, at this early stage in the asset to payroll ratio in the aggregate.
No, because everybody's still underfunded.
Yeah.
So any slowdown in the asset to payroll ratio is just because assets aren't going down.
And that's really where I think you're going to get some benefit much later on down the road, is the lower volatility in the contribution rate, because there's not as many assets on hand when you lose money.
But it's going to take a long
time. It'll take a long time.
Most people to fall off the mortality.
I will tell you, we can't help but stare at that, the other stress, or the main sheet that was up there, and think about what that sheet looks like with a real juicy 2016 return.
Let's see.
Anyways, we just kind of fantasize.
Well, I think if you put 17% into 2016,
17,
you end up back where we were projecting last year. So you
can
see
what it takes.
Wow.
So there was a negative 1.7% return, I think, and so you would need a 17 to. This year to offset that.
So that's Ed's job. Well, we had a 14. The year before Ed took over, we had a 14, so that's kind of what you promised us with that.
Well, it's been great seeing you again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Jody. So, is there a motion to accept the preliminary actuarial valuation results for 2016.
Motion
by Mandeep. Is there a second? Second by Joan Clendenin. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. We'll now move on to item 6C, legal and legislation update.
Nothing to report on that.
Okay, nothing to report. Moving on to item 6D, the information technology project update.
John?
This month we have a lot to report for our ITSE project. It's moving along very nicely. We are currently in the process of developing and approving many documents. Like we have a communications plan, a risk management plan, a data conversion plan. All of these documents are currently being written and reviewed by many, many people and are getting close to being approved. We also have had Tegret and now analysts here for 3 days a week, at least 3 days a month. We are also starting to do some Zoom meetings with them during the time that they aren't here. So a lot of staff time has gone into working with the analysts to make all of the preparations for the programming they're going to need to do to accommodate us. The scanning project is definitely underway. The company FNTI is the company that will be coming to do the scanning of the back file project, and they will be here the day after our next board meeting, so that will begin on March 29th and is expected to take between 4 and 6 weeks. However, we have made arrangements that they... that they will not be here scanning the day of the board meeting, so your room will be available. There will be no extra noise for you on the day of your board meeting. But there's a lot, too, getting ready for a scanning project. I personally am very surprised. We have staff working their little fingers off out there trying to get everything ready, and we're very excited. We think we're going to be right on time to be ready for them when they arrive. So that's a huge part of what we're doing right now. And I said that we are developing a risk management plan. That's one of the things that will be discussed every single week at our project managers meeting, and will be discussed monthly at the steering committee level as well. So any risks that are identified and are at the high level, at the high caution level, will be reported to you monthly as well.
Yes. Your scanning project, the contract, is that able to be used by other county departments?
The contract is actually with Tegret.
Oh, okay.
So that it's actually kind of sublet to them. But so far, we're really pleased with what it looks like we're getting and the feedback that we've received about their accuracy and the integrity of their process is amazing. So hopefully we will be able to report the same thing to you when this is done, and maybe we'll start a new friendship there for the county as well. Thank you. Uh-huh.
Any questions for Dawn? Okay, thank you, Dawn.
Thank you.
Moving on to item 7A, Legato.
Have Legato online. They're going to let us know if they can hear us.
Thank you.
Testing, testing.
This is a video conference.
We may want to just get Legato on the line, and you can see if you can get this to work in the meantime, because we need to move along.
Yeah, we're getting late here.
Sure. Since we don't have a permanent place anymore, I'm not sure how you want to do that. Because he says he's online, but we can't hear him. So it's not just the video technology.
Is he joined?
He said he was.
So go ahead and click update now.
Let's do that.
Don't we have a phone over there? That little orange.
We're going to start.
That's part of this.
There we go.
Yes.
That's like a, when you apply for a job, you just get a blink Hotmail. When you got when you were 12.
I can just be a TV on board at one time.
Can we call him?
Yeah.
We need to have a backup phone in the future. Right. We need to have a backup phone in here in the future.
Maybe it's for you. Yeah, it's on you.
Hi, Victor. Sorry for the technical difficulties. You're online with the full board.
Okay. Should we just do this by phone? Does that work for you?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for having us here today. This is Victor Hines, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Legato Capital Management. I'm here with Adam Lawler, Executive Vice President, Director of Investment. We encourage you to ask questions as we move through the material. In the interest of time, please turn with me to page 2. Specifically today,
Go ahead.
Thank you. We'd like to discuss developments in our firm, investment performance across our firm, client activity, the Spencera portfolio and strategy, the current manager lineup, 2017 activity, and certainly take questions. We had planned to limit our presentation to 20 minutes, excluding questions, if that is acceptable to the board, staff, and your consultants. If you'd like to wander in any particular area, please feel free to jump in with any questions as we move through the materials. Turn to page 4. 2016 was a busy year for us. A highlight of all the things that I think went on inside our shop, we became a PRI signatory. The PRI is the leading proponent of responsible investment across the globe. It works very hard to understand the investment implications of environment, social, and governance. ESG is the term you might hear in the marketplace, and the factors are what the signatories agree to incorporate into their investment and ownership decisions. So if you were to go to Europe today and talk to investment managers, billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, they have really fully integrated the ESG beliefs and measures in all of their work they do when they evaluate companies globally. So we've become a signatory, and that occurred earlier this year. Next, there were no changes in the investment team personnel, but Diana Tenhaker, who joined us in 2015 as a senior research analyst and sixth member of our investment team, continues to contribute to our process execution in a meaningful way. I've been very happy with the contributions she's made thus far. We actively made a decision to say goodbye to one of our administrative team members that are now interviewing for 2 administrative roles that should be filled by the close of April. We are also searching for a senior sales and marketing executive. Currently, our current staffing is about 8. We launched a new technology platform about a year and a half ago now, so that has certainly been a great addition to helping us manage the activity. activity we have going on internally. I'd also like to take a moment and comment on this past year in particular and talk about investment performance across our firm. You know, I was thinking about this on the plane today, and if I share the term low 80s and high 80s, you might not immediately know what I'm referring to. To clarify, these numbers represent the range of percentages of active managers failed to meet their benchmarks for year 2016 across the entire global equity public securities marketplace. I'm going to share this with you. Rather than lose hourly, as Magana said, such as this caused us to redouble our efforts in questioning everything we do and asking if we miss anything. For those of you who are familiar with our investment process, you know that introspection is a hallmark of our work. And having performed this for the 2016 year, there's an important theme that recurred in our work repeating here. Number one, the importance of taking a long view, realizing that this practice challenges even the most sophisticated clients during difficult times. Two, for us, while a manager's cycle from underperformance to outperformance could be as long as 3 to 5 years, a client's tolerance level may be 1 to 3 years. So in Legato, our job is to do all that we can to reconcile these time periods and hopefully smooth the effects of managers with longer cycle periods by placing them alongside managers with different patterns, and that's what we try to do as a portfolio. And finally, we continue to actively manage the portfolio in conjunction with our conviction ranking process and implement changes to portfolios as we have in the past. That being said, we continue to do this and are preparing to make some adjustments in the case of one manager in particular. At Legato, we currently manage 7 active long-only equity strategies for micro-cap and global equity. I'm talking about firm-wide now. While fewer than 20% of all active managers meet their respective benchmarks in 2016, 3 of our 7 strategies were ahead of their benchmark. We pay very close attention to risk-adjusted performance. So while it is a very difficult year, 5 of 9 portfolios that we manage on behalf of institutions achieved positive information ratios for the 3-year period ending 12/31/16. Assets under management have been fluid but positive, with firm assets under management rising to $1.58 billion from $1.4 billion at the close of 2015. I spoke about assets being fluid in 2016. This has really been a year of change, and I want to highlight some of the major changes that have taken place among our clients. After 3 years of managing a $20+ million all-cap international equity portfolio, we decided to close the strategy as there was not a favorable balance between the time required to manage that portfolio and the prospects for asset growth. Second, one of our 3 small-cap growth clients made a decision to move our portfolio to an index earlier this month. Third, another client asked us to transition their $90 million all-cap U.S. equity portfolio to a $150 million international small-cap equity portfolio. So we continue to see a shift away, or at least more of a balancing between domestic and international holdings in our large institutional portfolios. Finally, we received notification of a $250 million small cap core mandate from a new client and have been asked to prepare for funding of that particular mandate on April 1st of 2017. So before that particular portfolio is constructed, assets as of February 24, 2017 are about $1.55 billion. I've shared quite a lot of information and would like to stop for a moment and see if there are any questions about the firm.
Victor, I have one question.
Yes.
What percentage of assets have pulled out of Legato in the last 6 months out of your total AUM? What percentage is that of your total AUM? I'm sorry, what did you say? Say that again, please.
It's about 6%, I believe.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. And we've had assets go out and assets come in. So that's the balancing act. do that on behalf of Stan Sarah. AMI Asset Management and Reinsol James were added in September 2014, and since that time have added positively to the production of outperformance of the portfolio. And I should ask you to turn to pages 6 and 7. LMCG Investments and Castle Art Management have been a part of the portfolio since March 2010 and have experienced dramatic underperformance over the past 3 years and have been near but under the benchmark since inception on a gross basis. Our 2017 plan includes removal of LMCG Investments from the portfolio. They're currently ranked a 2 out of 5 in our conviction ranking scheme. And you may recall that when a manager receives a 2 ranking, they have 2 full quarters. It could be a shorter period to mitigate whatever the issue is that we've raised, or we will move them out of the portfolio. So we're in the process of making that determination and moving them out. If you please turn with me to pages 8 and 9. Our portfolio and small cap growth strategy have faced obviously significant headwinds. It is instructive, however, to take a moment to note that while 2014 and 2016 were very difficult years, the portfolio posted positive returns in 4 of the past 6 years. Obviously, extent plays a role in all of this, but we haven't changed the way we look at portfolios, and we know the process through which we apply to building portfolios using managers with a complementary style is still something that can lead to outperformance over the long term. With the exception of one manager, LMCG Investments, we affirm the strong conviction we've got in existing managers presented here today in the portfolio. You can turn with me to page 10 and 11. This estimated performance runs through January 31st. And while February's been challenging, we remain optimistic that the gradual rise in interest rates and potential for surprises both globally and likely domestically in policy and across all of the things happening here will lead to allow our stable of managers to see the opportunities to generate out over the next year. We're kind of stuck at 0% interest rate, and that varies range makes it very difficult for our managers to differentiate themselves, but we are looking forward to this environment of uncertainty actually in helping the portfolio. Let me stop there to see if there are any more questions.
Nope.
Hearing none, we'll actually turn to page 12, where Adam Waller will discuss the risk statistics, the attributes, and characteristics associated with the staff Sarah portfolio. On page 12, it shows the risk statistics for the portfolio since inception. The goal of the portfolio was to build a portfolio that can outperform in multiple market environments while taking risk. And although we're disappointed in the most recent performance, over the long run we've been able to add alpha, by taking less risk in the portfolio, while still maintaining a high correlation to the net low tracker to the benchmark. Page 13 shows the attribution for the fourth quarter. I know it might be a little late, but just to rehash, it was a pretty dramatic quarter from going into October and then through the election cycle. We were able to add alpha on a sector selection. It was a little challenging, a little headwind. We were underweight materials and financials, which hurt the portfolio, but we had a very strong stock selection within healthcare and consumer discretionary to lead to the outperformance. On page 14 and 15 shows the structure of the portfolio. On page 14 shows the sector allocations, and we try to build portfolios that are both sector style neutral, but to also have very little style and sector differences. The major differences in the portfolio is the overweight to information technology and underweighting the materials and real estate, as they've recently carved that out of financials and in the benchmark. On page 15 is the portfolio characteristics. No changes in the portfolio here. It's pretty much the same exposures we've had. The cap is slightly higher, but on the valuation, we're were in line with the benchmark, slightly lower on price to book and slightly higher on more PEs, and higher growth rates both on historical and forward. Quality, slightly higher while taking less risk with the lower beta. On the next two pages, shows the on 16 and 17, shows the makeup and the historical risk attribution of our tracking error. And just to reiterate, we are trying to build portfolios that take less style and industry exposures and risks, and have the majority of our track error be derived from the stock-specific risk. On page 16, on the last bar at the end of December, approximately 76% of our tracking error has been derived by the stock-specific risk. On page 17, shows the historical realized tracking error. Our target range is 3 to 5, and it is slightly below that now. We've had the last couple months, we really haven't had a lot of downside volatility. It's been pretty much straight up, and so we've seen a little bit of the decline, but we're not actively trying to reduce the risk and still maintain the predicted tracking error in the 3 to 5 range. Finally, on page 18 is the makeup of the track error within the styles, and really only 8% of our track errors has come from that, but the major drivers of that were underweight volatility and market sensitivity. So I'll stop there to see if you have any additional questions on the portfolio makeup.
Nope, keep going.
Okay. We did not want to take your time to go through each individual manager, but we can certainly do that if you would like. So if I hear something, we'll do that. Otherwise, I'll continue on. And I would draw your attention to page 31 in the book, and this is back in the appendix. We've said some things already about the organization and the people, but I want to highlight just a moment the conviction writing framework, and it's important because it's such a critical piece of our due diligence process. And in the interest of time, I'll draw your attention specifically to page 34. Give you a couple minutes to turn. The highlights of page 34 in our conviction rating process are a number. The first, there are 5 areas of measurement. The structure might be the only thing that's somewhat unfamiliar to many of you. And structure is basically a ranking that identifies things like managers that are managing highly concentrated portfolios. So if you have a small cap growth manager running a portfolio with 20 stocks, he might have a ranking out of 1 to 5, 5 being high, 1 being low, up to. So it's just a notation for us there. 2, the overall score, when we score each of these 5 important areas, does not get averaged, because we believe what happens with the average number is you start forgetting about the magnitude of the particular area that might be at the extreme, in other words, the 5 or the 2s. And so what we do is we have an active discussion about what the most important driver is of these 5 important areas that a manager. And that becomes the conviction rating. The rankings from 1 to 5, initially and on an ongoing basis, actually affect the allocation of assets in your portfolio by a particular manager. So all of the things being equal, a manager with a conviction rating of 3 will occupy less of an allocation in your portfolio than a manager with a conviction rating of 4. And then finally, as I said earlier, a ranking of 2 allows a manager a maximum of 4 to mitigate or be removed from the portfolio. We're in that situation right now with one of the managers. That concludes the formal remarks by Adam and me. You'll find the remaining appendices contain the compliance checklist as well as investment guidelines, and also the final appendix has a style classification chart which helps show how we break down portfolios. So with that, I will say thank you very much and ask if there are any questions.
Nope. It doesn't appear there are any questions. Rick, do you have any closing comments?
No.
Ed?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, and have a good day and productive meeting.
Thank you.
Yep.
Doing that bad?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lost. The way I read it, we lost $7 million in 6 years.
Yeah, they've, since about late 2013, they've been trending down quite a bit.
Yeah.
We're going to have a discussion on that in two or three months from now.
Thanks.
We've already got that on tap.
I would ask for the places.
Thank you both for coming. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Well, there's so much going on that we're going to take a look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
I know. You have to look at it.
The only thing that makes it makes it seem normal is the next guy's.
Yeah, used to be so good.
I know. Yeah. That's all I did.
Concentrated portfolio. What's the problem?
Yeah, they're down even more than that.
The ability to sell Qualcomm.
9 million, 8.5
Yeah, falling in love with it.
Well, to be fair, Rick, on the value add chart that Jim was looking at, that's the value relative to the index, right?
Yeah. Less an assumption for fees that we would have to pay.
Okay.
So it's not an actual, like, it's not an actual accumulative loss. It's just how much they underperform to the benchmark.
Correct. It's relative.
We just put our money into fund.
Yeah.
Right. In other words,
how far behind we are.
The assumption, right. Mandy, the assumption would be we would incur none of those bars with the alternative investment.
Yeah, that's right. True. Yeah, just put in the index and you're good.
Exactly.
Right.
No fees, right? Less
God
fees.
Less.
Well, there is fees, but they're
less of them.
Much less.
Let me try this again.
Yes,
I think it's going to work.
We did talk with the IT, and he believes that the error was on Legato's end and not our connection.
Not really surprised.
Yeah, based on the last 6 years.
So we do have Jackson Square ready to go, and they should be entering the room.
They got a great view out to the right of there. It's really nice. Still looking out over Alcatraz and the bridges.
So if those of you need to take a break while we're waiting, this would probably be a good time to walk down the hall and do that.
Good idea.
We're like, wait for more.
So if we all leave the room as the Jackson Square comes in, or empty,
and then they leave, and then we come back.
I'm also online.
The trouble with these guys is they have such a concentrated portfolio that they don't
always count on IT to
bad.
Yeah.
They hold stuff.
Set your meeting
too long
up exactly right for you, right?
They just didn't have their system running.
Yes, he believes that there's two ways to access it, by computer or by phone. And he thinks he might have done the opposite, like try to connect by computer but by phone.
They're overdue for real estate. I don't see many large capital managers over real estate.
There you go.
It doesn't change much, you know. I got to pay attention to all this. And I
they
was
did
really
say
surprised
they can hear
that
us.
They just hang on
to
the phone.
For
years.
So they can hear us, and then the others won't enter the room here.
10-4.
They did mute themselves until this time. There, I muted us. The one on the phone is there, which I believe might be Susan Heyman.
Okay.
She said Sharon Heyman, sorry. She did say she muted herself.
Okay.
To interrupt the meeting. And I just muted us. As soon as everybody was
We'll do it.
So Jackson Square is struggling.
Just recently.
I know.
One year.
Yeah, 1 year.
I was just like,
oh, they were.
I kind of want to ask what happened.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah. Okay.
Did there? Well, here's the deal with Jackson Square. They are a concentrated fund.
Yes.
They only have 30 stocks, so. Yeah, that's fine.
They have a lot of money, and that would yes. have a lot of volatility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I'm sure that it's taking June my form so that.
And I saw that.
Did you go to Antarctica? Yeah, yeah. It was that.
That was fabulous.
Wow.
Very interesting.
It's a long ways away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think. It's farther away than if you went halfway around.
That's okay. That was what we wanted.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Actually, yeah.
Because we're so far above that.
Exactly.
That midpoint.
Yeah.
What's the wind
like? Yes, I do have it.
It was 1 degree centigrade almost all the time, and the water was the same.
So in the mid-30s, right? 1 degree isn't 0.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, just above freezing.
I'll be darned. Wow.
It's not bad.
Was the ocean down there pretty rough?
If the wind came up, it got rough, and if it was a calm clear day, it was dead flat and gorgeously blue, and you could see way down there.
Really?
Yeah. Because unpolluted water,
Yeah.
And there's almost no alluvial stuff in the water.
Yeah.
Where is that?
Antarctica.
You didn't go there.
Oh yeah.
Really? Right. So many nicer places to go, you think.
They come on as soon as we walk out of the room.
And that's why I went. It's good enough reason.
Bucket list kind of thing.
Kelly.
Yes.
That's from
putting an article in the journal about active and passive investment.
I have a great book on that.
They need to go back.
It's bad.
My family came from. It was a pretty good convention. We had a few out of town agitators there, but the police kept them. But overall, it was pretty good. We had just a few resolutions, four resolutions, no flights, fights in the war or anything.
There were no fights.
No, there was nothing. I mean, it was.
A tribute to
yeah, I guess that's
right. I like Bolton.
Okay. Okay, let's reconvene since we have a quorum and they're ready because we need to move this along. So, hello, San Francisco.
No.
Hold on.
Someone's on mute.
Are they on mute?
Do you have a speaker
unmute.
In that room?
In the bottom right.
Do that. Mute. Do this.
Unmute all.
I already did that when we joined.
Can you hear us?
Hello? No.
All right.
How about now?
There you go. There we go.
Okay. The automated lady was telling us we were fine, but maybe not. So we lost your picture. Can you still hear us?
Yes. Yes.
Great. We're just going to go as if you're there. This is Kevin Brown. Good to see you. I usually see you in person, and so good to see you, if only by video again this time around. My right is Chris Erickson, one of the senior members of our team and one of the portfolio managers in large cap growth. You will hear mostly from Chris, as it should be. Maybe I would just take a minute or two to start, if it's all right with you, and please feel free to jump in and stop us anywhere along the road here. To give you a quick business and organizational update, as is typical for this part of the conversation. Not a lot has changed. You've heard me say that a lot in the last 10 years. Currently at about $22.7 billion in assets under management. The large cap growth strategy is still the lion's share of our assets, as has always been the case. There's been no change to our personnel since the last time we spoke. As you know, lots of tenure and experience on our team between Chris and another six or so members that have been on the team for a very, very long period of time. And then just to remind you that we've added five people in the last 6 years now, just in the effort to get deeper, maybe get a little younger on the team, which we think is a good thing, and kind of sort of building out the bench, if you will. No change, though, to any of the portfolio management responsibilities. All the PMs are the same on all the strategies, including large cap growth. And no change to the organizational structure that you've come to know, almost coming up on our 3-year anniversary of our spin out into our own independent entity away from Delaware Investments. That'll happen this May of 2016. No change to our product lineup. No thoughts of doing anything different in terms of another product, or I'm just going to stay the course and continue to do what we've been doing all these years. I'm happy to pause there for a second. That's a very quick overview, but I think those are the major points. I'm happy to pause and ask for any questions on any of that or to go deeper on any topic there.
Any questions? Nope. Keep going.
Okay. So I guess one last thing I would offer before we get to the business part of the conversation would be, the investment part of the conversation. One last piece of business. I think it's something that we might be able to take offline because we want to obviously save most of the time for the investment conversation. But we've done lots of thinking around here in a lot of different ways, obviously from an investment point of view and also from a business point of view. The industry trend and the fact that we have not necessarily recently, given 2016, demonstrated our value proposition to clients, we've started to think more creatively about different kinds of fee structures and getting creative on that front. I don't want to hijack this meeting for that conversation, if it's okay with you. We've already previewed this a bit with the folks at Verus. We're happy to follow up with them and with Rick or whoever the most relevant people are for that. And so happy to do that at another time, but just wanted you to know that we think creatively and importantly and even aggressively about fees and fee structures. And so we'd like you to know that. We'd like you to come back to that in more specifics another time, if that's okay with you.
Seems to be fine. Keep moving.
Great. I'm going to keep the mo going. And one last part as we now shift to investments and do what I've always done with you guys and folks in the past, which is just to remind you very quickly the way we manage money, especially if there are new people in the room. Very quickly, growth, long-only growth equity team based in San Francisco. Our basic philosophy and process is to run concentrated portfolios. That's typically 25 to 30 stocks. We think about both risk and reward, not just trying to find 25 or 30 home runs, but 25 to 30, a collection of those companies that we think have the right risk reward individually and then as a group. We try to own companies for a very long period of time, 3 to 5 year time horizons is sort of our minimum time horizon that we think about either a new position or something we've owned for many years. We constantly think about this 3 to 5 year time horizon. And then finally, is the idea that when we value companies and the way that we define growth is based on cash-based metrics. So cash flow and free cash flow and the return on invested capital and the way that management teams at companies think about their own cost of capital and the way that they allocate capital, all of these are cash-based valuation metrics that we think about the way we do our 10-year discounted cash flow analysis to come up with price targets for companies. I think that's a little bit different than most growth investors. We don't define growth by some revenue growth rate or reported earnings growth rate. It's really about the growth of cash flows and how that is important to us as equity shareholders. So again, brief overview on the general philosophy process. Happy to get out of the way, have Chris be more involved here from the investment point of view. I'll stop to see if there's any questions in the meantime.
Nope, keep going.
Great.
Great. Well, thanks, everyone. So Chris Erickson speaking. As Kevin had mentioned, I've been on the team for a long time now, coming up on 13 years, which, as Kevin alluded to earlier, until the last few years, that still made me the young person on the team prior to our adding a few other vintages of people in their 30s and their 20s. But you know, as he had mentioned, kind of long tenure on the team and indicative really of kind of the long co-tenure we all have together, where, you know, we've got sort of people who work together here ranging from 13 to, you know, kind of 25 plus years now. And no real change in that core team for a very long time. So what I thought I'd do is talk for just a handful of minutes about sort of our assessment of 2016 and how performance got as sort of disconnected as it did from the indices last year. Talk about what we think about it, what we're doing, and then really kind of stop there and let you get into questions, because I know that you as a group like to get into the Q&A relatively quickly. So if it makes sense, that's the approach I'll go forward with. Okay, so for 16, so obviously a year that we were very disappointed in, the fourth year of calendar underperformance in the 23-year AMER compliant history of the record going back all the way back to Transamerica. You know, our assessment of the year at a high level is that certainly we had a handful of meaningful unforced errors in the portfolio in terms of stocks that we just got plain wrong. You know, we will have that from time to time. We have had that historically here and there. And in a concentrated portfolio format, the names that you get wrong, they can stay. And that certainly happened last year, and we own that. What we would say, you know, sort of that alone would have resulted in our having a bad year. What took a bad year to something worse than that was the fact that it was also, 2016 was a year that was very difficult for us from a style perspective in terms of how we do things, whether our names are liked or not liked in a given period of time in the market. We typically find that those, quote, style factors, you know, when you run the modeling services, the attribution services, they will say that in most years they don't tend to be that big a headwind or a tailwind. The much bigger driver for us are how our stocks do, or stock selection, as people will put it. And that's not surprising, given that we are concentrated. We do tend to own 28 names, plus or minus, in these portfolios. But last year, what we found was that nearly half of the underperformance, as measured by these models, was attributable to sector weightings and these style factors, which was completely outsized relative to kind of what we've seen in most historical periods. And so it really was that combination of handful of errors on the stock side, which, you know, clearly things we got wrong and we're very happy to talk about and own and talk about the lessons learned. There certainly were a few. But also sort of this headwind that we were facing in terms of these style factors that really showed up in two parts of the year. The first part you've already heard somewhat about in terms of our last conversation. We talked about in the early part of 2016 that there was a real rush toward higher dividend yielding equities, so names like Procter & Gamble, Clorox, and others that already had relatively low growth in either revenue or earnings and already had a relatively high PE multiple. Those things actually got even higher PE multiples as people rushed toward them in a flight to safety, if you will, trying to get to higher dividend yields. You know, we like dividend yields in this team, on this team, this product. We like return of capital. That's an important part of sort of stewardship of a company from our perspective. But we much prefer that return of capital come in the context of a company that has secular growth tailwinds behind it that are allowing it to continue to grow its revenue kind of at least in the mid-single digits and preferably higher, but also has, you know, light enough capital intensity in the model where they can go ahead and return capital via dividends. And so you really didn't have the first part of that equation in terms of the names of reward in the first part of last year. And that was not only difficult for us, that was difficult for virtually every active manager. And so as we saw in the early part of last year, active managers in general were having a really hard time as those names were running and they were not kind of well owned anywhere. That was the first part of the style issue. We also, at that point in the year, healthcare, particularly pharmaceuticals and biotech, had been out of favor, and those are sectors historically where we've been able to find teams with good secular growth characteristics, good defensible kind of competitive advantage positions, et cetera, the things that we really look for that are core for us. And for a variety of reasons, they were out of favor at that moment in time, and that also was sort of difficult. Fast forward to the end of the year, and you had the sort of the other portion of the style issues, if you will, open up in that post-election, there was a real rush into names that historically are not things that we, you know, not areas we spend a lot of time in, like heavy industrials, like some of the cyclical energy players, et cetera. Names that were generally perceived to be winners in a Trump administration-led world, you know, where they may not have been not only not meaningful names in our portfolio, but or even meaningful names in our benchmark. But what happened was, in our view, that, that our names, our secular growers, were sold to enable other people in the markets to go buy those names, to chase them. And so what we saw was, in a really quick period of time, kind of in the 3 weeks post-election, that literally half of our portfolio had traded down by 5 to 10% in absolute terms. On basically no news, little or no news kind of in any of those instances. In the meantime, the index was sort of up slightly over that period. And so you guys can do the math as well as we can. If half the portfolio is down kind of mid to high single digits, you know, in a period when the index is flat to up, that's going to create a performance hole again. And, you know, and from our perspective, that was all about style in that, you know, our names were and are not going to be meaningfully impacted from a negative perspective, we believe, in sort of a Trump world. It was just that they were not perceived as being the immediate winners of potential Trump policy changes. And so they got left behind as sort of the, you know, the rest of, you know, people rotated into, you know, Citibank and Bank of America and Caterpillar, and you can kind of name some of the other names, which are historically have not been names by and large that, that we've been able to own because we don't feel like they have enough competitive advantage or enough sort of secular growth tailwind, growth in their end markets for us to want to own them. And so when you add up those factors, difficulty in some names, again, which I'd referenced earlier, and we had talked about to some degree already with this group, happy to discuss further in any amount of detail as we would like, but difficulty in some names combined with some of these, if you will, style headwind that, that contributed to what was, a, you know, admittedly a very difficult year, a year that, that we feel the pain, we believe, as much as any client on a number of levels, not least of which is that we all have our personal money in these products. I can just tell you from my perspective that putting aside money that I hope to put into a down payment on a home this year, if I'm fortunate, I have over half of my liquid net worth in this product specifically, in large cap growth, the product in which you are invested. And so, and that's not unusual in terms of representation in this team. And so we all feel it very personally, in addition to kind of feeling professionally. So why don't I pause there for a moment and ask if there's any specific questions on what I just said. If there isn't, I'll go into kind of what we, you know, what we're doing now, what we're thinking about this now, and then pause for more.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm just a little bit confused. Is the issue of not reading the market correctly after the election a style question, or was that just a stock picking problem on your part?
Yeah. So we view it as more of a style issue on a number of fronts, not least of which is that we think that there is real potential for meaningful change in the economy and, you know, sort of long-term winners and losers as a result of Trump policy. That's certainly, that possibility is out there. But if you look at the way the stocks have reacted relative to the likelihood of earnings profiles meaningfully changing for these companies in the near term, we think there's a real disconnect in terms of the way the market has treated this stuff. So, for instance, you have lots of names that, in theory, would benefit from a trillion-dollar infrastructure program that moved very substantially, kind of, you know, in the very kind of short period of time post-election. The reality is that most of those potential beneficiaries are not going to see those earnings in 17 or 18 because none of these projects are really shovel-ready. You know, the permitting process that has to get done, even just beyond the notion of sort of getting legislative approval for this stuff, is daunting and will take years to sort of get through before we really begin to make, you know, real progress on these things. And so we think the market substantially pulled forward these developments on a number of fronts, and in many cases was kind of not right to do so. And so we think that that, you know, we would call that sort of style, if you will. You know, further, there are moments in time when secular growers like Google, Visa, MasterCard, et cetera, are less loved than others. That's certainly true. But what we tend to find is that when there is a flavor du jour, and I don't want to sound glib, but when there is sort of a preferred trait of the moment, they can fall out of favor for a brief period of time. But as they put up more and more quarters where they beat earnings and they show they continue to grow very robustly relative to some of these other names that have been in favor, they tend to come back into favor. And so that was, as I mentioned, you know, across, we had literally, like I said, half the portfolio kind of trade off on basically no news post-election. We view that as a sentiment change as opposed to any kind of fundamental change. And so, yeah, we would describe that as a stylistic thing as opposed to something that was about sort of meaningful fundamental change in our names and therefore, quote, errors.
All right, well,
does that make sense?
I think it kind of makes sense, but I think you might be misreading the I don't think it's style. I think it's pretty fundamental.
You don't think what?
The Trump administration change is a stylistic change. I think it's a fundamental change in the country. But
I don't think we know yet.
We'll see.
So it's a good question. And it's something that we've debated, as you'd imagine, a lot internally here. And we're certainly open to the notion that, for instance, some other managers have talked about that animal spirits might begin to be unleashed by a deregulatory push, you know, that infrastructure spending might ignite sort of growth in the economy like we haven't seen sort of post-crisis, et cetera. We're open to all of that, and we have, to some degree in the portfolio, we have some names that are better positioned for that than others. But right now, we would say in terms of what has actually happened and the prospects for things that are happening in sort of in the near term, you know, and again, the stock market more than ever these days is more focused on what happens in the next handful of quarters as opposed to the next handful of years. You know, there isn't really a lot of evidence of it right now. I mean, you guys have, I'm sure, followed the policy debates as we have. And, you know, and so the, you know, the Trump people and Paul Ryan and others would already have loved to have repealed Obamacare and replaced it with sort of their, you know, sort of Republican version of it and had tax reform out there, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and it feels to us like consensus is moving. In terms of consensus, even among the Republicans, it's getting kind of, you know, further split as opposed to coming together. So we're open to the prospect for real change, and we're ready to move in this portfolio if we see that change. But quite frankly, right now, we're not seeing it. We're not seeing it yet.
Is there any other questions? Because I think we probably need to move this along just a tad. We're running behind here, guys. Really, really.
Okay, got it. So I will pick up the pace. Apologies.
Just go Q&A, or we just ask for questions,
yeah,
just given the clock might be ticking on your end.
Any questions?
No.
I think I have one comment I'd just like to say, get it out there. We've had good success with Jackson Square in the past, and I think that a concentrated portfolio of 30 stocks, we're going to see this from time to time. So I don't necessarily think that what we've seen in the last year is that unusual. And on the flip side, a concentrated portfolio of 30 stocks could turn around just as quickly. Am I correct, guys, in San Francisco there? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's you, Rick. I hope you have a direct line to God, or the market gods at least. But yeah, I think you make a good point that we, yes, a strong yes to your assertion. And secondly, we have seen this before, actually, our own experience. In fact, you know, you guys, you may not remember it, and not all of you were involved, but you have actually enjoyed that snapback with us in the past. You know, there was a period in early 2007, which was relatively early in your inception with us, where we looked at, if you just took that snapshot in time, you know, you might question our sanity, and we were lagging pretty strongly. You know, we were, you know, 900 and something basis points behind on a trailing 1 year basis, and we actually ended up outperforming in 2007, even in that calendar year. And so yes, there is absolutely, it's sort of the deal that we have signed up for here when we take this approach. We know that
we aim, frankly, to be different than the benchmark, that sort of by definition, being concentrated, having a long-term horizon, having a cash flow paradigm and valuation, these are all things that are very different than consensus investing. They're very different than the benchmark. So we know we're going to be different. We actually want to be different. Most of the time, we've been different in a good way. There are times, though, where it's been difficult for us. And like you guys, as Chris mentioned earlier, the double whammy of our own mistakes combined with maybe some market flavors that we were, you know, really out of favor with, you know, and not in sympathy with, really added to this double whammy of pain. So we get it, but they can reverse, and it has happened for us before, thankfully. Obviously, I'd love to be able to guarantee that it'll happen again, but we're doing the same things here in terms of staying focused on companies and long-term horizons. We know in the past that was the way to get out of these performance cycles, and that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, as Kevin mentioned, we in 2006 we had our first underperforming year. It was a difficult year. 2007 we had a bounce back year. In 2008 we had a difficult period. 2009 was a bounce back year. 2010 was a difficult year. 2011 was a bounce back year. It doesn't necessarily mean that 2017 will be a bounce back year. History suggested there should be some of that. You know, certainly we can't make a call on that, but that would be what the history would suggest. And as Kevin had mentioned, you know, we have had difficult moments here before. And maybe the most difficult was in late 2010, early 2011, when we had come off a five-year period where we'd underperformed in three of those calendar years. And what we did then is, and what we've learned from those experiences is exactly what we're doing now, which is to say we're sticking to our knitting. We are doubling down on the portfolio, on the sort of work that we do that find the kind of names that fit for us. And we are doing everything we can to avoid chasing names that are working in the short term. We have seen more than one competitor firm blow themselves up by having a difficult period and then chase into things that work, and they work for a little while, and then suddenly they don't, and they get whipsawed. And we're not going to do that. We're going to continue to do what we do, and we're going to dig ourselves out of this thing as we have in the past, hopefully quickly. But if not, we'll do it over the course of years.
All right. Thanks, gents.
Thank you very much. Any further questions, Jim?
I just had one. I heard you say that Caterpillar was a company you wouldn't invest in, but a couple of years ago you did own it.
So Cat was a name that we had a brief run with a few years ago, and thank you for remembering. At that point, I'm sorry?
I remember everything. I pay attention to what you invest in.
Thank you. So at that moment, Caterpillar had, we thought that they had a chance to enhance the return profile and diminish the cyclicality of the business by virtue of some changes they had made at the company. We concluded after about a year that that was actually not the case, and we ended up selling, for kind of not any real change in the absolute price of the stock. And so it was fine. We were wrong on the thesis, but we didn't get hurt on it. And so I say now that Cat, as the company that it, you know, probably always was, that would be one that wouldn't necessarily fit for us kind of in the current paradigm, even though the market likes that kind of story right now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think he got in out of it at the wrong time. The one thing I just noticed, you have such a concentrated portfolio, and you keep these stocks year after year, stuff like Qualcomm. You had that when we first hired you. It just seemed like you have several of these that have been in there for years and years. And I think you limit yourself by not looking at other stocks and not getting out of some of these ones you've been in 5-10 years.
So that's right. We do have several names in the portfolio that we've been in for a long time. And the reality is that we're very happy to stay in names as long as they are continuing to stay on plan from our perspective in terms of continuing to grow revenue, free cash, growing their competitive advantage profile, and so forth. We don't see any reason necessarily to trade in and out of things based on, you know, sort of very short-term changes in sort of sentiment around the stocks. What we have done is we've changed the weight pretty substantially in some of these names, depending on sort of how they are perceived in the market in the nearer term, and whether we think that there is a more substantial risk-reward opportunity, meaning more upside to sort of fair value at a point in time. And so what you've seen in names like Qualcomm is that they've gone from top of the portfolio, call it a year ago, when we thought that they were among the most sort of juicy names that we had in terms of return profile. But then after the stock had rallied by over 50% kind of during, you know, last year, we pulled back on it pretty substantially, and now it's literally right at the bottom of the portfolio. You know, Google's another one that we've had in the portfolio for over a decade, and we've made very handsome returns on. Visa and MasterCard would be comparable. Allergan was a sore spot for us last year, admittedly, but we'd owned it since 2000 and had made a huge amount of money in that one for clients as, you know, really the Botox and the ophthalmology franchise grew, and then ultimately ended up selling in 2014 to activists and made a very nice return for us in that year. And so, you know, we're very happy to have names in the portfolio for a long time, so long as we think that they're continuing to sort of execute on their plan and they're not sort of those, the change isn't fully appreciated by the market. And so, you know, we're happy to do that. We don't always get those right, but the history suggests that for the most part, the names that we've owned for a long time have worked very well for us.
So we expect you guys to be like the Patriots and defy the odds and win the Super Bowl. So that's what we want. So is there any further
questions? I volunteer to be Tom Brady.
I'm sure you do. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for the ongoing support. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Go Cal.
Go Bears, that's right.
Okay, we're going to, since we're getting a little long on time here, we're going to take closed session out of order since our counsel is here, and we can get him out of here and at least get that discussion out of the way and moved on. So we're going to take item 10B, isn't it, Fred?
10B.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just 10B.
We need
a motion.
We do. So I'll entertain a motion to move into closed session.
I'll make
motion by Donna Riley. Is there a second to move into closed session? Thank you. So we have a motion and a second to move into closed session. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. And let the record reflect that alternate retiree Joan Clendenin has left the room.
Because I have to.
Because you have to. Yes.
Have a good ride home.
Hopefully. Yes, thank you.
Nice to see you, John.
Yeah, thanks.
We missed you. We missed you.
Ten four.
We left from a place called
Hawaii. We're through with B. 10B, we're done.
Very bottom.
Yeah. We'll go back to the other ones here in a moment. So, all right, so now we're on to 8A. And, Ed, when you get to 9A and B, just for a point of moving this along, you've got 5 minutes to cover those two topics. So.
Wow. Good luck with that.
All right. Item 8A, stands here, a schedule of directives, directives number 2 and 3. This is a discussion and action item. Our recommendation is to approve directives 2 and 3, and I'm going to turn this over to Ed Hoffman.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rick. So I think you have the materials in front of you. I don't need to read these, but these are two directives that continue to build out the investment policy, and so we have the investment policy statement as one document, and then these are the directives that are more fluid and more modular approach. And so what we have here, we approved Directive 1 last meeting, at the January meeting, which was the asset allocation table. So that's Directive 1. Now, Directive 2, we've drafted something that helps us review investment strategy disposition. And we've referred to this before as investment managers, but, you know, technically that's not right because we have managers managing multiple strategies for the plan. So we have this labeled investment strategy disposition, and it walks through a logic of how we evaluate the strategies and how we evaluate the managers. And it really focuses on what we in the industry call a 5P principle. And the first two P's are what you see all the time, the pricing and the performance. The other three are the people, the philosophy, and the process. And those are the engine of any investment management firm and any strategy generating the investment results. So in the directive towards the bottom, there are 6 bullet points that essentially follow these. The sixth one being regulatory considerations. So, you know, if the SEC found something or there is fraudulent behavior or something else, that would also kick us into a high alert status. Within the investment policy statement itself, there is emergency termination language. So if there was fraud or, you know, sudden departures of key people, you know, something tragic happens, there are steps that can be taken there. And that's really on the shoulders of Rick and Kathy to take immediate action to notify chair and vice chair, to notify custodian, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a number of steps outlined there. I think this one now provides us with a good, thoughtful process to review strategies similar to what we were discussing earlier. Whenever we see underperformance, let's take a thoughtful approach to how we evaluate that. Directive 3 is titled the proxies for illiquid strategies.
Back on that. So, like, if we, you know, assuming there was a manager, like what we talked about earlier tonight or today, that we wanted to terminate our relationship with, we have to go back through this process
right.
to do that.
Right. It creates a process by which we do that. So that helps.
So when does this, like, kick in?
Right now, as soon as you approve it.
Okay.
And so that's why we may be utilizing this in a couple months here.
That's right. That's
right. Not maybe, will.
So okay. These are like the guidelines, like, for example, underperformance, how long should, you know, the underperformance be? I mean, for one quarter, or, you know, is that in the procedure somewhere else, or will that be?
Yes. Yeah. So this is the framework by which we would analyze.
Yeah.
So when we take a look at that, we want to consider is the engine still doing the right things the right way, and they're just dealing with market cycles that happen, and we see with a lack of managers, or no, is something changed with that engine? And it's not the same manager that we hired back whenever it went. So it helps create a framework for evaluating that, exactly.
I think it forces us to take a thoughtful look at what we're doing, too, without doing anything knee-jerk, making knee-jerk reactions on some of our managers. Mm-hmm. So these are principles that would guide us as we discuss the disposition of the manager.
And there's also a carve-out in this directive to say that if we're changing managers due to changes to asset allocation, they don't go through this process. So if we're saying, you know, what might be a good example? If we were in commodities or something like that, and we go through an asset allocation study and we say we're not going to be in commodities anymore, and we terminate that strategy mandate, that makes sense. We're not going to go through this process because it's not really due to the manager, it's due to the asset allocation decision. Right.
So who starts this? Who says, I think we should do this process on X?
It would be a board discussion, board approval, saying to initiate this course of action.
And or then, we could bring it, too.
We could
bring it.
We can bring it. So we can make the recommendation, but we wouldn't really be able to do anything until we get the direction
right.
from the board.
And then it comes back in a couple months
yep.
after you cross it, you check it all out. Okay. I'm good with that.
Is that it, Ed?
Number, did you do 3?
I was about to step into 3.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
So Directive 3 is for illiquid strategies, recognizing that we're going to be allocating more to private credit and private equity mandates. We want to create a table, which has yet to be inserted, but we will insert it in future drafts of this, that outline exactly what we'll be using for our proxy strategies. So this is, Directive 3 is almost more of a template than a directive at this point because we don't have the table included. But it gives us the framework that the table will be created in the future.
Okay. That summarizes it very distinctly. I guess that's a word. Anyway, is there a motion to adopt Directives 2 and 3.
You want to do them separately or together?
No, we can do them together since that's how it's on the agenda.
I'll move.
Okay, moved by Jeff Grover. Is there a second?
Second,
thank you. Any further questions, discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay. Back to Ed now.
So I'm going to use one of my 5 minutes to shamelessly plug our client summit that's coming up at the end of August at the Park 55 Hotel, not far away in San Francisco. So this is just to save the date. The save the dates went out electronically, but I don't think they made it to a lot of you. So you now have hard copy. so.
And I can say that I went to the one in Seattle, and it was very timely, and they kept it on track and kept the day very full. So some, unlike some kind of conferences we go to, this one didn't feel like a waste of my time.
High praise.
Sold.
It wasn't a waste of time.
Is it just the one day, so you have two different dates for the same?
Oh, it's spread over 2 days now. Okay. Part of the feedback was that day long was a lot. We did pack it pretty full. So now it's an afternoon, starting on Monday afternoon, continuing through to through Tuesday morning, then ending on Tuesday morning. So it's 1 day conveniently spread out over two.
Okay.
Let's see, both start at 1 in the afternoon?
Starts at 1 and ends at 1.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, that's this one is confusing.
Yeah. You know, commute time and all of that. Yeah.
Fix that.
It starts at 1 on Monday?
Yes.
And when does it end then?
On one.
It's a marathon. It's 24 hours, Jim.
Starts on one at Monday.
With no break.
It's an attention getter. That's what it is. Attention getter.
All right. We're cutting into Ed's 5 minutes here. So.
The other thing I wanted to mention before I get into the market review is that Verus issued a press release. And so similar to when an investment manager issues a press release on an organizational change, we bring it to you. And that's important because organizational stability is important in our business. Our press release highlighted that we are selling a piece of our business known as Strategic Partnership. It is part of our outsourced CIO business. It essentially is a key component of our outsourced CIO business. And we're taking that piece and selling it to Goldman Sachs. They were interested in acquiring it from us, and we worked out a deal to do that. So we expect that deal to close first quarter, first half of this year. Closing is always a little bit tricky, but we'll be working expeditiously on that. It involves about 10 people in the firm, roughly, who will be transitioning to Goldman, including our current CIO, Jeff Scott. And the CIO position will be taken over by Ian Toner. And if you've gone to Sackers or Calipers or what have you, you've probably heard Ian speak. He's a Scottish fellow, so you probably can't understand a word he says. But he's pretty interesting and entertaining. So he'll be our CIO going forward. And Max Giolitti is staying with us, and he'll be our Chief Risk Officer. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those. And then we can jump into tab one and take a quick tour around the world. So what I'd like to do is turn first to page six. So this slide titled, What Drove the Market? That's an interesting view of the world pre- and post-election. In the upper left-hand corner, we have some of those numbers, page six, right? Page four. So upper left-hand corner, you see S&P 500, November 9th, 2163, end of the year, 2239. That's about a 3.5% increase. And since then, we've seen about another 5, almost 6% increase.
Is it Trump?
What page is that?
Yeah, upper left-hand corner. Post-election euphoria. 10-year Treasury also moved pretty significantly, 2.06% to 2.44%. So a sell-off in the bond market. Page four.
So to me, a quick review of the small cap market on Bloomberg didn't look like the market was down.
It did really well.
So when they were talking about how this had been changes, the market had been since Trump was elected, I wasn't clear on exactly what they were talking about.
Well, so, right, fair enough. Felt a little light in supporting data points to me as well, but I think what they're trying to say is active managers in their space underperformed. The index rallied nicely. A lot of active managers did not participate in that as much. I think that was the point they're trying to convey.
Okay.
That's my observation, but I'm with you.
Good.
Next section down on the left-hand side, we have consumer sentiment. And this number is just jumping off the charts. So July 31st, we're at 90. You see how it increases up to December 31st at 98. January number came in at 111.6. February number came in at a 16-year record of 114.8. So it was last hot that high in 2001, which, if you remember, was kind of there's a tech bubble going on there. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of euphoria that we have in consumer sentiment right now, which is interesting because along with rates going up, mortgage rates have ticked up. And so you would expect that to have some impact on house values, housing values, which are near and dear to so many people's hearts. And yet those numbers are also ticking up. So home sale numbers are ticking up there too. So we're seeing kind of a theme here. We're seeing higher growth. A higher growth agenda is what the Trump administration is putting forth and what people are hearing. We'll see if it comes to fruition. Also higher inflation, anticipation that growth is going to lead to higher prices. Also keep in mind that trade policy has a lot to do with inflation because for so long we've been importing deflation. If we have to now have tariffs and border taxes and such, and that raises prices, we will see inflation out of that.
Do we know if consumer debt is increasing?
So consumer debt is basically stable and ticking up, but household net worth is very strong. Huh? Yeah.
Because of what's been happening probably over the last 8-9 years, that they're deleveraging their balance, their personal balance sheets.
Right, right. Much more prudent management and asset values have recovered, stocks, bonds, and equities. So that's pretty solid. Okay, now let's turn to page 6, the one I had you all go through originally. U.S. economic summary. GDP is showing here in the upper right-hand corner at 1.7. Nothing fantastic, but it was 3.5% in the fourth quarter. 3.5% was a pretty good print. We like that. Since then, we've gotten two glimpses at the first quarter GDP, fourth quarter GDP. So third quarter GDP is 3.5. Fourth quarter came in at 1.9 and was then revised to 1.9. So the revisions offset each other. So we're still looking at kind of 2% economic growth, nothing fantastic. Inflation has ticked up. Here we're showing 1.7. Since then, it's registering at 2.5. So we are seeing higher prices. Fed funds rate, 0.5 is the target. It's actually trading at 0.56, so that's what the Fed is doing. 10-year rate, 2.5, that's actually come down to 2.35. And unemployment has stayed around 4.7-4.8%. So overall, we're looking pretty good. Looking pretty good. The bottom number is participation rate, though. U6 unemployment remains a bit higher than we would like to see. So there are still a lot of people standing on the side. Let's see how that compares around the world by turning to page 18. Page 18 has a couple interesting points on it. One is on the left-hand side, there's some text talking about inflation, and that this is headline CPI in the Eurozone coming in at 1.1%. So they're not quite seeing the inflation side of things yet. The ECB continues its quantitative easing efforts like we were doing here. They're still doing them. They were expected to end in March, and they've been extended. They've been tapered down a little bit. They were 80 billion euros a month. Now it's going down to 60 billion euros a month. That's really interesting to us because the banking industry is what needs to re-liquefy itself, and that's what we did here. Our banking industry is much stronger today thanks to quantitative easing than it had been. They are behind us. They stood by and watched quantitative easing and didn't jump into the game. Their banks continue to suffer. Now they're in an awkward, or they've been in an awkward state with negative interest rates, which is hard for a bank to live in, negative interest rates with the quantitative easing trying to help them. Now we're seeing rates modulate a little bit and start to come up. That's good for the banks. The quantitative easing strategy that they're doing continues on, but Europe is essentially behind us. And so you think then, okay, the banking industry has these issues to deal with. That's troubling. But quantitative easing, when we did it here in the U.S., equity markets rallied pretty significantly. So it's a pretty powerful tailwind to what's going on there. We also have a lot of this populist sentiment. So we saw Brexit and we saw Trump get elected. Now we're looking at Marine Le Pen get a lot of press in France. And it's the same kind of thing. It's a protectionist, it's protect our borders kind of mandate. And that's really catching on quite a bit. So there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe, and that gives us some hesitation. But that being said, with a tailwind like quantitative easing, like what they're doing, that generally plays out to be a good thing. And you tend to want to invest where things are shaky because they tend to resolve themselves. So we'll see. I mean, we're not there yet, but that looks like an opportunity with some volatility to it. On the right-hand side, we have a bunch of statistics on various countries. One thing I wanted to point out here is Brazil. We've talked about Brazil before. They have a shrinking economy, minus 2.9%. They have fairly high inflation, but not as high as they've seen before, 6.3%, and an unemployment rate of about 12%. Over the last 12 months, their equity market has rallied 56%. So sometimes looking at these safe havens isn't always the greatest place to invest, and they're obviously doing a lot to clean up the corruption that they have in their system, and impeaching Rousseff was a big part of that. Okay, I'll skip that page even though I like it a lot. Just a time. Skip that page too, even though I like it a lot in the interest of time. I'll ask you to jump to page 27, the equity environment. This page gives us a couple interesting insights. One is it shows a number of equity indices around the world. So here we have U.S. large cap and small cap, value and growth at the top. But then we get into international large cap, Eurozone, UK, Japan, and emerging markets. And we have two numbers for each of these columns, what they are in local terms and what they are unhedged. So, in other words, if you were an investor in Japan during the quarter, you earned 16.1%. If you're a U.S. investor in Japan equities, you only got 1.2. Why is that? Because of currency. And the currency impact is huge. So for the longest time, people in my position have never had to talk about currency because it was helpful. It was a tailwind to returns. And the dollar continued to weaken, 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 and as a result, returns were higher. Now that's shifting backwards, and so there's much more discussion about, and so what do we do about our currency exposures? We're doing a lot of research on that. You'll hear some of it at the client summit. You'll see some publications. We have an article coming out in Sackers magazine talking about it more and more and looking for cost-effective solutions that work well with your plan and with the currency exposures that you have. So it's a pretty interesting animal to tackle. I think we'll be talking to you more about it down the road as we get further into FFP and what we can actually do about it. But you can see how profound the numbers can be over a one-year, even quarter period. All right, and then I'll wrap up with page 41, which is the S&P 500 sector returns. And on the left-hand side, you'll see the financials have the great, strong quarter here, 21% return in the quarter. A lot of this with expectations that Trump's administration will pull back on the regulations, and therefore the banks and the investment managers and the insurance companies will do quite well. And so that's what a lot of that return is built upon. A couple other interesting things, though. We've gone through January and February now. So we've gotten the earnings announcements from the S&P 500 companies, or most of them, 90% of them. And here's how the numbers stack up. 66% of the companies beat on earnings expectations. That's pretty normal. 52% beat on sales numbers. That's also pretty normal. We see a year-over-year growth in earnings of about 5%, 4.9%. So that's better than expectations. Expectations were for about 3. So coming in at 5 is nice. Take it for what it is, 5% off what was kind of lower earnings a year ago. And we're now looking at a price-to-earnings multiple of 17.7. That's not low. With interest rates where they are, with economic growth where they are, that's not exceptionally high either. So it's kind of like cautionary. We're looking at it saying, certainly not a screaming opportunity. That's a high PE multiple relative to some other places around the world. But it's not one where we're saying pull back from domestic equities either. We're saying they're high. Now, for them to be supported, we have to look forward. What's going to happen next quarter? What's going to happen in 2017 overall? So let's take a look at that. Earnings expectations by the analysts, not our team, but Wall Street analysts, are expecting earnings to grow by 9.3% this coming quarter, quarter one, 9.3%. So that's pretty high, with revenues increasing by 7.4%. Now, those numbers will change all the time as the analysts update their opinions on every company out there. But that's what we're looking at today. For calendar year 2017, they're looking at growth of 10% in earnings. So basically, you're saying all the growth is going to come next quarter, 9.3%, and then just a smidge coming the rest of the year. Same with revenue, actually even a different story on revenue. The 7.4% growth in the first quarter is going to yield a calendar year growth of 5.5%. So they're actually expecting revenues to decline over the remainder of the year. An odd environment. And again, while our markets have done well, and while we're feeling really comfortable and safe and everything's going great, we're not seeing it from a bottoms-up perspective in terms of earnings expectations. So I think we kind of heard a little bit of that from Jackson Square saying, you know, some of these infrastructure plays are going to take years before they really come to fruition, before we see it in the earnings. I think that's true. I think a lot of the thoughts about the repeal of Obamacare and how that's going to help or hinder the healthcare providers in a number of ways hasn't really impacted the earnings expectations yet. The analysts haven't. They don't have enough to change those numbers, and so they've basically been where they are. Presumably, they'll have some impact. We just don't know if it's positive or negative. So let me pause there, and if there are any questions, if not, we can jump into the performance of the plans.
Move on.
Shall do. So tab 3 has the performance for the quarter. I'm sorry, I skipped over tab 2. Tab 2 is the flash report for the month of January, and you can see that the total plan earned 1.6% in the month, net of fees, with a fiscal year-to-date return of 8%. So we're not quite to Graham's 17% yet, but we'll keep jumping. Tab 3 is the performance for the quarter. And if we turn to page 1, we have the portfolio reconciliation. Yep, same book. We're just at tab...
Tab 3, page 1.
That's the other book.
Joe, you're in the wrong book.
Yeah.
Let's turn back to the other book.
You need to be in this book.
No. Is it there's only one small label at the bottom. Wait. That one says risk parity. That one says...
Okay, cool.
So page 1 of tab 3 has the portfolio reconciliation starting the quarter at 1.835 billion. You can see the net cash outflows, investment change, so ending slightly up, 1.859 billion. Page 2 just showing a history of the asset growth and outflows, the asset allocation history. Page 3, I do want to note that we have a no in the IPS range column on the right-hand side. With regard to small cap value, we're currently overweight there, 5.4%, against a maximum of 5%. So we have the new asset allocation table that was approved at the January meeting, and we're migrating to it over a three-phased approach. So we're not recommending any changes right now. Small caps have had a terrific run. We saw some pullback in there. I wouldn't be surprised, and that 5.4% may very well come back down to 5%. So I don't see any need to take any action based on that. Overweight. Page 4, when we take a look at the total plan, this is gross of fees, but it gives us a sense for our relative rankings. A couple interesting things here. One, the relative rankings are stellar, so that's great, but we have to pay our own bills. No one else pays ours, and we don't pay theirs, so I always take it with a grain of salt. But total fund for the quarter, 1.9% gross, fiscal year to date, 6.5. And an interesting thing is, for the quarter, as you look down this column, every one of our composites outperformed the benchmark. So take, for example, U.S. equity. We got 5.2% U.S. equity blended and Russell 3000, both below that. So we outperformed in U.S. equities. International equities, 0.2 versus the negative 1.2. So we outperformed there. We outperformed in fixed income, real estate, plus direct lending, and infrastructure. So a pretty remarkable quarter. It's usually we preach diversification because when some things are up, other things are down. This time, everything was terrific, so we'll take that. Skipping ahead to page 6, taking a look at the asset allocation risk analysis. This page is always helpful when we think in a couple months we're going to be talking about the asset allocation. And this is the page that helps us measure that. So here at the total fund level, you're seeing annualized return over the past 5 years of 9.16%. And a couple columns to the right of that, standard deviation of 6.8%. Both of those are very favorable. We think of this portfolio as probably something designed to generate about a 7% return with probably a 12% standard deviation. And then taking a look at page 7 through the individual investment strategies, we have a number of index strategies, and we heard from Jackson Square and Legato, so I won't make any comments there. Dodge & Cox had a terrific quarter and a terrific 2016. It wasn't long ago that we were talking about them having some troubles, but they've really done well. So they're overweight financials by 14%. So pretty significant overweight there, and if you remember, financials was the number one sector.
Didn't the fellow that was our relationship there for like 30 years retire?
Yeah, Bob Thompson.
And they just took off. I don't know if there's any correlation at all.
They had some losses, and I heard that the reason they're doing so well now is they just didn't sell.
That's right.
And their value, so I had a few stocks to do that too, so I can relate to that.
No,
so that's not because they were real good managers. They just got lucky, and the stuff that they had just went up in value.
Well, lucky and good are interchangeable terms in investment management. So, to your point, they are very comfortable being out of favor for an extended period of time. And so those stocks that they were saying, we like these. We like these banks. We like these financials. We're way behind the benchmark, but we don't see any reason to sell them. They didn't, and they stuck to it. So, but they followed that discipline for so long that it's hard for me to call it luck at this point. I mean, this is a firm that has been doing exactly that through cycle after cycle after cycle, and they're just very patient. So, a couple other interesting things, though. They did own a Time Warner, which was up 52% due to takeover talks with AT&T. Goldman Sachs up 35%. Hewlett-Packard up 54%. Hewlett-Packard probably has come back. They didn't have a great earnings announcement. Bank of America up 33%. And Sprint up 133%. So, yeah.
You know, one thing that's interesting on page 7, if you look at the top up there, and you see the portfolio's total return for 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, you know, you hear so much that we can't make the actual bogey, but that statement really is only made in the context of what period of time you're looking at. I mean, over 5 years, we beat the actuarial benchmark by almost 200 basis points. But then if one were to choose 10 years, you could say you underperformed the actuarial benchmark by 200 basis points. So when you hear things like that, you need to make sure you understand the context that the statement is being made.
Taking a look at page 8, just to wrap up the individual managers, we also had some pretty terrific performance out of LSV for our international equity mandate. They have about 21% allocation to emerging markets. They were also overweight financials, underweight real estate, and underweight consumer staples, which all helped drive their performance. I think this one is interesting because their short-term numbers look terrific. 1 year is at 10th percentile and have handily outperformed the index. 3 year number also outperformed, 5 year okay. But if you take a look a few columns over to 2015, 2014, 13, and 12, there was clearly a time where this manager was underperforming and where they weren't looking good on a relative basis. And you're probably doing some head scratching on that, saying, should we get rid of these guys? And this is the kind of active management cycle that we see them exhibit, that they will go through periods of underperformance. And typically, if they stick to their knitting, they'll enjoy this up performance. So good to see them recover there. Nothing particularly noteworthy through the rest of the managers. We are going through the process with the liquidity program, so we'll see changes to the fixed income portion of the portfolio. On the real estate side, numbers pretty consistent with prior quarters. The Prime Property Fund generated about 1.1% income and 1.6% appreciation. They have about 17% leverage on their portfolio. The American Strategic Value Realty portfolio is about 1.9% income, 1.6% appreciation. They have 43% leverage in their portfolio. And that's typical for a value-add strategy. So that's where they're at. But, you know, I think sometimes we talk about leverage, and we will be talking about leverage again with risk parity. We have leverage in the portfolio. It comes in different shapes and forms and different likenesses, but it's in there, and it has to be. Skipping ahead to page 11, we'll take a look at the closed-end funds. Page 11 is really the progress of our funding, seeing how fast we're getting the money put to work. So the top one is the real estate greenfield gap fund. Committed $15 million to it back in 2014. They've called about $11 million of that, and we have an estimated market value of $13 million, and they've no distributions yet. And then we have the direct lending strategies with Medley, Raven, Raven, and White Oak. You can see how these are progressing. Raven was actually in the office, in our office, yesterday, it was Monday. So I had a chance to meet with them and get an update on the wind down of Fund 1. They anticipate coming to us with a request to extend the terms of the fund by 2 years. I said we'll take that under advisement and take a closer look. It's because they have a remaining portfolio of, call it 6 or 7 investments, and those will all be winding down over the course of the next year or so. But there's one that's a shipping interest that they think is really worth riding out because the shipping industry is recovering, or they're seeing recovery in it, and they're getting paid, and they think that 2 years would be prudent. So we'll have to take a closer look at that.
That's in Raven 1?
That's in 1, yes. 3 is still getting underway. They're making good progress on putting that money to work, and so these numbers are a bit dated relative to the capital calls they've made in the first quarter and what they expect to make over the course of the first half of this year. So we should expect to see that called capital increase pretty significantly, probably into the 60% range by third quarter. So coming. And then White Oak, have that there. So those show how the capital is being called and distributed back. And then page 12 has the performance, IRRs for these strategies, gross and net, for Stansera in particular. And so you can see not all of these are stellar. Greenfield Gap is looking pretty good so far early on. Medley, 5%. Raven 1 coming in
3.5.
So we should expect to see that increase as they have these final dissolutions, divestments. Raven 3, that one's still getting underway, so we're in the lower part of the J curve there. We'll watch that hopefully come up, and same with the Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Fund. Okay. And then page 14 has the fees for each of the strategies. And then tab 4 has the risk dashboard, which I think will become more appropriate as we fully embrace on the FFP concept, and we can take a look at how those numbers will start changing. But we're not managing the plan to those parameters yet.
Okay, we'll roll right into risk parity mandate.
Risk parity mandate, okay, so that's the other book.
Got it.
And if we turn to page 4, I'd like to take a quick view of the executive summary and outline what we're trying to get here today. So I think the book is helpful, and there's a lot of great information. I don't intend to read every page of it. Every other nap, but fewer than that. So on the executive summary page, this is page 4 behind tab 1.
By the way, before we start, this is a discussion and action item, and we might want to tell the board what that is.
That's right on this page. Right?
Oh, you got it? Perfect. All right.
So the executive summary, we're talking about this risk parity strategies as part of the asset allocation for the plans. We're currently targeting about 14%, which roughly is $260-some million. So it's sizable. And therefore, we would be recommending that we select multiple managers, given the percent of plan assets and the size. I think we would want to get this done with 2 managers, 2 separate complementary strategies. And then the last bullet point here is what we're seeking the board's approval. So this presentation concludes with a recommendation that the board direct staff and Averis to conduct on-site due diligence with selected investment managers, determine portfolio structure, and present a final recommendation to the board at the April meeting. So it's going to take us some time to do that work. That's why I don't think we could get it done in time for the March meeting. But that's what we're seeking. We did an education session on risk parity back in February of 2016. If you remember that, we had Tana Gore come in and talk to us. And so this will be the third piece of phase 1 of the FFP approach. We did U.S. Treasuries. We did the liquidity mandate. This will be the final third piece. Once we get all these pieces together, then we would rebalance the plan into these strategies. skipping through a few pages to page 11. Some of those are the backup education slides you've seen before. Page 11 shows essentially what we do in finding strategies and finalists to present to you. Very similar to what you would see if you were to conduct your own RFP. You'd shoot it out to all the risk parity managers out there. We think there are 20 that are actually institutional worthy candidates. That's the top of the funnel on the right-hand side. We do in-depth quant analysis on 15. We do further analysis, qualitative review, brings it down to 10. And detailed due diligence and write-ups on 4 and 3 that we think are appropriate for various considerations. So this is a little different. If we were doing large cap value, that funnel would start off with thousands of managers. We'd be trying to get it down to a few. Here we're starting off with 20. There aren't that many who are really good at doing this kind of stuff for that long that we would consider it institutional. It's a unique skill set. It's something different.
So you've already done the winnowing down.
Exactly. Yeah, let you out of all the fun. But that's natural to help gain some economies, right? In terms of if we're doing this for you and for all of our other clients, we can just bring it to you to the table because we put it through that diligent process. Page 13 gives you a quick thumbnail view of each of these three firms. And so the left-hand side is AQR, which I believe is an acronym for Applied Quantitative Research, out of Greenwich, Connecticut. They're kind of the 800-pound gorilla in this space. First Quadrant in Pasadena, California, just down the road, and Panagora out of Boston that you heard from. So all three of these we think are worthy considerations. Several lines down, let's see, 5 lines down, you'll see target vol, target volatility. Each one of these managers is showing 10%. They're all trying to manage a strategy that creates 10% volatility by investing in equities, bonds, and commodities in different proportions and in different ratios. Max leverage, you see some pretty big numbers here, 300% from AQR, no limit for First Quadrant, although they're actually lower than the other two, and Panagora at 350. And if you remember back to Panagora's presentation, they apply leverage to the fixed income portion of the portfolio. So what they're doing is they're saying, we need more bonds than we can buy. We have to do it with futures because that's how we have to create that risk component in the portfolio. So that gives us comfort that we're not out there trying to leverage up gold or something like that, some risky asset. We're leveraging up the safest asset because we need more of that safety built into the portfolio. This is essentially how they're constructing the portfolio. So I think that's a really important clarification point there. And then under strategy inception, you'll see that AQR is October 2011, and we like to see these strategies having gone through the 2007-08 timeframe, and they have a sister strategy managed almost identically to this that goes back to 2006, and that's what we use for our analysis. What's different here is what we would recommend as a strategy to Stansera is one called their GRP-EL, where EL stands for extended liquidity. The extended liquidity means they're not going to invest in private credit, they're not going to invest in anything that they can't get out of on short-term notice. So in their normal strategy, they can invest in private markets, like we invest in private markets. But here, they created another one because they got so much feedback that that's nice, but we don't want you to do that. So this is a strategy that stays away.
So why do you think that that's better for Stansera? Given the fact that we've initiated the FFP, why is that a concern for you?
Because the risk parity asset class that we're putting in the FFP construct is part of the hedging. So we have the liquidity portfolio, the growth portfolio, and the hedging portfolio. We're putting it in the hedging portfolio, and part of the mission of the hedging portfolio is that when the growth portfolio corrects, when we have a market correction, we want to be able to go there to pull assets out to invest.
I see.
So liquidity is a big concern for that. Okay, at the very bottom we have the fees, and I think this is important to note too, because as sophisticated as these strategies sound, they're actually pretty reasonably priced. We're looking at 38 basis points from AQR, some blended amount from First Quadrant, probably right around the same ballpark, and then Panagora at 35. So these are pretty cost-effective strategies. And then page 14 just gives the statistics on how these strategies have done. Again, in the interest of time, happy to answer any questions. But the second line down does show annualized standard deviation. I was talking about how they're targeting 10%. Each one of these has enjoyed lower standard deviation, lower volatility. So 7.8, 8.5, and 8.9. And they've generated positive returns while doing it.
The less standard deviation, the better, the lower number.
Generally, yes.
What is the Sharpe ratio?
That's a kind of a ratio of return to risk. So it's the return versus what is considered the risk-free rate divided by the volatility. And it's kind of like saying, okay, I'm getting more return, but am I just taking on way too much risk to do it, or am I being really smart about not taking on much risk at all to get it? So again, higher Sharpe is better.
Do the two numbers above that give you that ratio?
Not directly, because you need to know the risk-free rate that's being used, okay. But essentially, yeah.
When it talks about the percentage on of fees, mm-hmm. is that on commitment or is that on the actual?
It's on our investment. So if we invest $1 million with them, they charge us 35 basis points on $1 million.
Once they get $1 million, or?
Yes, so there's no call time with these.
Okay.
It's all put to work overnight kind of thing. Okay. Yeah.
So are you asking us to allocate the money today to
no.
these three?
Okay. No. What we're asking is for your sign-off for Ferris and staff to go out, conduct a more due diligence on these three managers, and come back to you with a proposed plan of saying, here's who we'd recommend and what percentages and how we would fund it.
Where are you going to take the money from?
So the idea is to just select one out of the three, or?
Likely two out of the
two
three.
Two out of the three.
Yeah.
Is it possible? Oh, sorry.
There's you just don't do that in April, right? You plan on bringing that
yes.
study back yeah. to us with recommendation in April.
That's right.
But isn't there only two evaluations? So
there are two write-ups provided.
There's one of them. I just figured you discarded this one.
First quadrant, yeah. So first quadrant is... It's a little bit different than the other two. Let me just show you on page 17 what led us to that thinking. So we started to take a look and said, okay, what if we combine two of these managers in a 50-50 allocation? Which ones look the best? So we did each of these paired. AQ Panagora, AQR first quadrant, and Panagora first quadrant to see what comes out best. And the AQR Panagora kind of jumps out at us. So it was kind of like, okay, that's looking like a pretty good pairing from a first glance. Run the numbers, see how they come out. Highest Sharpe ratio, max drawdown, not quite the lowest, but very reasonable. A track record that goes back to 2008, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It looked pretty good. The other thing that's interesting is first quadrant applies human intervention into their process. And risk parity, if you think about proper risk parity, it doesn't do that, except in extremes, and then they can call an investment committee meeting or something like that. First quadrant regularly utilizes a human intervention overlay to it. So that's something that's a little bit different. I think our research team is more comfortable with that than I am in terms of what would be a good fit for the plan. And then, yes, the write-ups are included, and I know that these are long and boring, but these don't read like other managers, so I think if you're curious about this stuff, you'll enjoy these reads. These are a little bit different, and they'll raise some questions.
Does everybody feel comfortable with the strategy itself, or is there a need for a, not today, but a short primer again on this strategy next month, a 10-minute? Yeah.
Let's that would be this. Nice, but then we're putting in 250 million.
Yeah. So we can spend 10, 15 minutes next month and just review this.
Yeah. And then behind tab two of this book is a search book. I'm not going to take you through that, but this is the kind of thing that is generated through that search process. And so this is all of the download from the databases that we subscribe to, all of the analysis, very quantitative approach to the recommendation. So the first part of this presentation is a more qualitative review and thoughts on best fit. That back part is the numbers. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
So the sharp ratio, the higher the number, the better?
Yes.
You might tell me again what the sharp ratio is.
It's your risk versus reward.
It's the unit of reward that you get for unit of risk that you take, essentially.
So
it's like saying that you're going to get a dollar versus $1.25 for the exact same risk. And you want to go for the $1.25.
That's a ratio.
Generally speaking, a sharp ratio is pretty solid. You're talking about standard deviations over a long period of time as you know, your risk, and the rewards are pretty clear, you know. Because we're looking historically, we're not necessarily looking forward.
Okay, any further discussion?
If we need, Kelly can read again the recommendation.
I'll read it back here. I got it. So the recommendation again is that the board direct staff and Veros to conduct an on-site due diligence with selected investment managers, which are in the document provided and which Ed went over, to determine portfolio structure and present a final recommendation to the board at the April meeting. So that would be the motion. Anyone want to make that motion?
I would make the motion.
A motion by Donna Riley. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mandy. Thank you. Any further discussion?
It's a big bite.
It's a big bite. But right now, we're just finishing up that whittling down and going through that heightened due diligence process. We're not going to make any final determination.
This doesn't allocate any money.
No,
this
no
doesn't
money.
Take money away from
further diligence.
Where it's correct. Currently allocated.
That's right. Correct.
Further diligence, and that'll be back in 2 months. 2 months.
And next month we'll have a 10-minute short review of
right.
the strategy.
Update.
Again.
So we've had a motion and a second. The chairman's going to call for the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. All right. We will now go back into closed session. Is there a motion to move into closed session?
I'll make a motion.
Motion by Donna Riley.
A second.
Second. Thank you. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay. We are now back in open session. And if you're wondering why I'm gabbling, it's because they can mark the time on the recording. So it's not that I'm eager to pound the table. So whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So
IT assistance.
So we'll now hear the report out on item 10A from closed session.
Motion was made by Trustee Joan Clendenin and seconded by Trustee Jim DeMartini to acknowledge and approve the findings and recommendations of Hearing Officer Michael Loeffler regarding the matter of Jeanette Apollinar on her application for non-service-connected disability and to deny the applicant Jeanette Apollinar on her application for non-service-connected disability. Motion passed unanimously. That's all I have for closed session.
Okay. Well, now members forum.
I'll pass. Nothing.
Nothing.
I was on the website today looking at the tiers, and the tiers still say that our board sessions are Wednesday at 2 o'clock.
Minor?
They do.
Thank you.
All
we will check that.
Where are you looking?
I've been coming every Wednesday.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, I will not be here in March.
Okay.
And I strongly object to the length of this meeting and suggest that in the future, if we're going to have meetings with packets 2 inches thick, that we have a special section, divide it in half.
That was discussed previously, I know, so.
I'm not saying you have 2 meetings every month. I'm saying under special
right.
circumstances.
Sure.
Have a special meeting.
Okay.
I mean, this Mine don't have.
I don't have anything.
I didn't think you would. Jim?
Did you ever talk to the county about them trying to roll back our retirement reforms, therefore department heads? Has Stan ever talked to you?
Well, you're not.
No, are you talking time. About the negotiations?
I mean, I'll wait till next month.
Remember the item I called you about? Because that was going to get put in the legislative platform. I got it stopped.
Yes, I have talked to them. That appears to me completely off the table right now.
Yeah, I really objected to it, and I was going to call that vote against it. So they backed down and took it out.
Yes.
I didn't know if they'd ever talked to you. But
they did. We talked about it right before the negotiations, the bargaining groups. We kind of laid it out why it's probably not a good idea.
Okay, good. I just haven't heard.
Bass?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sam?
Nothing.
Indeed.
County's hosting an ethics class tomorrow. In the board chambers, 2-hour class, late from 6:30 to 8:30. So I plan to attend. Thank you.
Nothing from me.
Kelly?
Just would like to remind you that you have SACRs, and I don't really have anyone going, and the rooms are very overbooked. We're on a hold for the overflow. So if you have intentions on going to the spring SACRs, I will need to know as soon as possible so I can finalize those plans.
Yeah, put me down.
Put me down.
And those are in May. Aren't
Napa.
Put me down.
Put me down.
I thought I told you already.
I have rooms reserved for you.
Got it.
Don't have anything finalized.
And four.
Put me down.
Okay.
And then did you do Monterey for next week?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Rick?
Nothing.
Well, hold on. When we talk about, I got like 1 minute before Trustee Grover says he has to leave, so I'm going to utilize my 1 minute. I think there is a way to still utilize the one meeting a month that we have, but format these meetings in a certain way so we can get through them. And maybe, you know, with everything that Ed had, maybe put him at the front end, I don't know, and get that through, and then take some stuff after that we can get through. But I mean, to go through all of that and then have Ed have to kind of compress everything on our performance and everything, kind of rush through it. And I was sorry to see that, but that happened. I'm open to suggestions on how we can. I think we can still do it within one meeting a month without having to come here at 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever. But we just have to reformat what we're doing. Beyond that, I don't have anything else.